97 WRAF HD1 Detroit.
Now,
this is Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. Or text the riff at 4WRIF. That's 4974. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Oh, wow. If there only was a camera in the studio, this would be absolutely incredible. Hi, Jalene. Jalene promised me as soon as the mics went on, the show would go on because...
I'm a little stressed out right now.
What drama here at the Riff. Absolutely unbelievable.
It's
weather-related.
Weather-related.
Totally.
Like, this is no big news flash to anyone local who's listening.
Well,
now, if you're listening on the podcast later in the week, well, we're having a big old blizzard.
Yeah.
And Peter and I didn't think when we got here that we were going to even get in.
And the
parking
lot.
Peter took
a flying something.
He backed up and said, we got to go. I go, well, don't hit anything. I'll try not to. And he got us in here by the grace of Gaia.
Gaia, yeah. Well, let me say this. My wife and I live about three blocks from Jalene, and I got stuck twice coming to pick her up because I figured one car.
What are we doing here?
So that we're doing a talk show, and you can call us at 248-544-WRIF. Your turn.
I don't have anything. 248-544-9743.
And so what happens with these plows, and you may experience this on your streets if you get city plowed as well. You plow out your driveway, right? And then these things come by and bury the entrance. And that just happened again. Why they are plowing these streets back here is so far beyond me.
Because they're not even plowing in our city yet, and
no.
This is an area that has
industrial
no
area.
Police force. It's shared duties by the state police and the Oakland County Sheriff's Department. There's no fire department, but boy, are there streets plowed. Thank you, Mr. Plowman. Thank you very much.
She's casting an irreverent hand sign towards the plows that are going by now. Anyway, this means nothing to you if you are just sitting at home like maybe everybody should be.
And if you're driving...
Very careful.
I'm sorry.
Hey, here come the plows again.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you. Hey, come on back. Why don't you do some more damage? Because we want to spend the night here.
You know...
Werby and I are going to find a couple of chairs.
Chairs, indeed. Well, and at 5 o'clock, it's Dave and Chuck the Freak.
Yes.
Are they going to be here?
Peter, they can't even get in here.
Yeah, that's
by
true.
Then, I'm sure it'll be remedied.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
This, we always talk about the issues of the day, the political issues,
the
social issues.
This is the issue of my day right now.
Yeah, and but still, I'd be interested in hearing people's storm stories, short ones. But they should be combined with also the opinions
now,
of what we're talking about.
You are such a control freak. Did you hear what you just said?
No.
I'd like to hear your stories, only short ones, and it should be combined with something related to the show.
Right.
You're unbelievable.
Hey, if you'd like to email us, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And also Facebook, that's there. Tell you my guests I'm going to be. Those will air regardless at 1 a.m. Eastern tonight. And I say Eastern because people are listening all around the world, including in some sunny climes.
And we have no one answering our phones
well.
We have no phone screener.
The phone screener couldn't make it.
We started from zero and we're going backwards, folks. But we're going to still take your phone calls because I am going to multitask and somehow that will get my mind off of my anxiety that I'm feeling right now.
Hey, cuidado. But look, the only thing, maybe I shouldn't even say this, but Jalene is saying,
whatever
you say that, it's something you shouldn't say.
When you call, we're simply going to be answering and putting it on hold. So we're going to take cold calls tonight.
Yeah. And let me tell you this, that, sometimes, people are rude or what have you. A couple of things. One, this now is like on a 30-second delay. So
even if you want to get funny with us.
Yeah, and get rude.
You're going to get the slam down.
Say the nasty.
Peter has his finger on what is called the dump button.
The dump button. Yeah, I'm going to take a dump if you say something.
No, they will take a dump.
Right, they will take a dump.
Already a couple people calling in.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Hey, what the hey?
You asked for it, Peter.
Yeah, let's do it. And here, well, I will say that as we go along. Since we do not have our, our phone screener. I don't know who's calling, but let's do it this way. Hey, you're on the air.
Well, who's this and where are you calling from?
Turn your radio completely down, okay? Are you there?
Me?
Yeah, you.
It's you.
What's your name? Where are you calling from? First name.
My name is Jake, and I'm from Brighton.
Yeah, Jake.
Hi, Jake.
And,
I'm actually one of the plow guys, not county or anything, private guy, but...
Tell us about this plowing us in thing.
Well, I'm sorry if you live on a curve or anything on the road, but it gets a little wild.
But like, we appreciate that you're out there. We do appreciate that you're out there. I didn't mean to be mean. I'm just personally frustrated because I thought I was going to have an anxiety attack trying to get in here.
You're not going to come down here and
you
want to
come plow
out.
Us out?
I mean, you guys got $100?
No, the station does.
Peter, do you have $100? Come on, Peter, get us out and get us home tonight. No, actually, our boss has offered to come get us if we can't get out.
Got a big old Jeep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really nice of him.
Nice
boss. I've been out since 4 o'clock today, so.
Oh, all right.
I bet you have.
Yeah, well, what I would do would be to get some sleep and get ready to plow again.
Let's let the guy talk. He called in, and we haven't let him say a word.
I did.
No, a word.
Say a word.
No, Peter, go ahead. Tell us what you wanted to call about.
He wanted to call about this.
I was going to say that this storm is the worst I've ever seen, and I've been plowing for almost 6 years now.
I got to tell you this, and I meant to say this at the beginning. We have lost our winter chops because winter is back in the day.
Yeah, but this is out of the ordinary, Peter.
Yeah, no, but it used to happen all the time. Yeah,
I don't know about all the time.
All right, my friend, thank you very much.
Global
keep plowing.
Warming.
Yeah.
Hey, let's argue that tonight.
Yeah. Well, that by the way, that's one of the things. Oh yeah, now I'm back on focus.
And by the way, keep plowing and be safe. And thank you for doing that because someone's got to do it, and we appreciate you. We know it's probably just kind of crappy out there for you.
If you're on hold, stay there. We don't have a phone screener. We're going to take you cold, and when you get on the air, just say, hey, this is Al from Sterling Heights. Al, you out there? But here. So what I did when I saw all this snow coming, and it was hitting all over, and it's like a high tomorrow in Minneapolis, 13 below is the high, low, 17 below. It's warmer in Anchorage, Alaska. So it's in the 30s in Anchorage, in Alaska. So I started turning to all these awful right-wing news sites, and guess what? Their feature stories, rather than Obama is a secret Muslim or stuff like that, was guess what? It was the weather, talking about the storm, because these morons are still into, oh, it's so snowy and so cold, that means there's no global warming.
Right.
It's
right.
Just a left-wing plot.
Hey, I have good news. I have a breaking news for just you and I, Peter.
Okay.
I got a text message from our chief engineer. Said the plow service said they'd be out before we leave.
Oh, great!
Yay! We love the plow people.
Yeah.
Quickly we turn.
Now, here's what I'd like to ask you, and you can comment on the weather and all that as well. But why in the world has like this climate change thing become like this right wing thing? I mean, what is motivating them? Years ago, I heard that the multimillionaire right winger, what's his name, Rush Limbaugh, saying this is a plot to take away your SUV. I mean, he actually said that.
Oh man!
So I mean, here are all these climate scientists that almost uniformly, anybody not connected with one of these right wing outfits, research outfits, or with one of the oil companies, is saying that this is human-caused global warming because of sending up all this crap into the atmosphere. So,
all the chemicals.
Yeah. So How did it become, I mean, it's odd that sort of environmentalism is associated with the left as it is. I mean, proudly so. I mean, but why wouldn't everybody across the board want to protect our environment? And this is where the phrase conservative comes in. They want to conserve things exactly as they are, no matter what the damage it does to people, no matter what the damage it does to our planet. And I just don't get it. I mean, there was a time when there was a lot of Republican conservationists. They really cared about the planet, the national parks, all of that. And suddenly you just have these crazy people that say this is part of some, you know, big plot to have big government do something or other. But let me put it this way, and I have before. Let's say that it's not settled. It is. I mean, if 90% of your climate scientists say that there's global warming, I'm willing to accept that. And you say, well, how do you know? I don't know. I depend on these guys. I depend on experts for a lot of things. Doesn't mean that expert opinions can't be challenged, and we should do that. But there is unanimity almost among climate scientists. So let's say we have two ways to go. We could either be conservative and just stick with what we have, all right, and just hope that, in fact, it is a left-wing plot, you know, the calling for measures that would stop this, what we're doing to the planet. Or we could err on the side of caution. We could make a mistake, but we can do it because we're out of caution. And because we could be spoiling the nest. And here, we could do this. We could say, okay, we got to put into place all these environmental safeguards. We could go more and more to alternative energy. And wouldn't we want to do that anyway? Doesn't that make a lot of sense? Maybe as opposed to these crazoids that are just in denial? Wow. All right. Hey, you, what you think, and any weather stories. 248-544-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you. Let's take another caller. And, hey, caller, what's your first name and where are you calling from?
Hey, greetings, Peter, Jalene, David, San Francisco.
Well,
hi, David. Oh, how's the weather
about
six, there?
About 64.
Yeah, it was one of the warmer days out here. But I'll tell you, actually, we are in the middle of one of the... if I remember right, this is the longest, this is the lowest amount of rainfall in California's recorded history.
Really?
Yeah, and it's very dangerous. It was about like 2-3 weeks ago, if I remember right, it was between Christmas and Thanksgiving. There was a huge frost up that way, up your way. And didn't it all melt off, though, by the time Christmas got here or shortly after Christmas?
That would demand a memory of several weeks.
It's been kind of off and on, really more
right.
than anything.
Well, see, that's where the problem is. Out here in California and Colorado, where I used to live, in order to have water for agriculture, you have to have the snowpack in the mountains, and it has to stay packed until April or so.
Right.
And then as it melts, it provides water throughout the spring for the crops. Well, we've been getting these, they may have a huge snowfall, but if it melts 3 days later, that doesn't mean that there's going to be water for the springtime.
No, I know, and that's a worldwide phenomenon. Some of these landlocked South American countries that depended on glacier melt, slow glacier melt, in order to provide water for just everything, not just agriculture, those glaciers are all but gone. And so we're facing drought conditions all across the world.
Yeah, and the solution to it, of course, every climate scientist says that we've got to plant more trees. There have to be more trees. The trees are 80-90% water. They're going to provide shade. The more blazing sun that comes down, we've got to provide shade for the smaller plants to grow. And growing more trees, and in a bad economy, provides the need for having Johnny Appleseeds out there just, you know, planting with abandon.
Well,
think about all the clear cutting that's occurred around the world.
Yeah,
that's
clear cutting of forests.
Scary. So you got to make up for that first, and then you need to add to it.
And during the Depression, President Roosevelt put into one of these make work programs, but it was very important. It was called the Civilian Conservation Corps, and it took all the thousands of young unemployed men, and there was incredible unemployment then, of course, and set them across the United States planting trees. And we could do that again for sure. David, all right. Thanks for calling.
Always good talking to you, David.
Yep.
Enjoy your balmy weather.
Right.
Right, we hold nothing against you.
Let's take another call. We don't have a phone screener tonight. He couldn't make it in, and he, it was impossible.
Well,
we wouldn't let him.
To let him come in here, yeah.
Bad snow. We're kind of snowed in here at WRIF.
No, they're out plowing right now. We're cool.
That's good.
I look how calm I am now.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I'm back to the good old calm Julene.
So when we when we say hello, please, your first name and where you're calling from. Hey, you're on the air, caller. Who's this?
Hello, yes, ladies and gentlemen. This is Big John from Brownstown. How are you?
Hey, Big John. What's up?
Big John.
Now it's your turn.
Hey, I'm in a world of hurt, guys. In a world of hurt right now.
What's happening?
I got 3 plow trucks right now, and we're buried.
Oh.
Oh, so you own a plow. See, we're going to have a lot of plowers calling tonight. So buried are you?
It ain't stopping. It's not stopping for nothing.
The snow.
I plow 1 hour with my F-350, and I'm another hour, I'm back on it again. My other man, my T-16, 213, it's just one of these things, you know. Well, what I want to say, I'm scared for not only for this. I think this is just what's going to happen. With the earth, and you were talking about, you know, that you're worried about things to come, you know.
Yeah. Climate change and all that, yeah.
Scary.
I believe that if nobody out there right now can see, they have blinders on, can you not see the changes in what has happened and what is coming? I mean, this is just, I mean, guys, we got people in Mexico skiing on skis. We have people in Arabia that's never seen snow in their life, and we have a foot of snow on the ground.
Yeah,
now, to me, this is getting a little bit scary to me. You know, in all my life, all I heard, I come from a preaching family, you know, and I always like, well, you know, this is that, this is that. But now I'm starting to believe. And I just want to know your take on it, Mr. Werby.
Well, call me Peter, for sure, and Peter and Jolene. And, I think that there are a number of scientists. You don't, you know, this is why I said you have to err on the side of caution, because there are some climate scientists that say we are close to the tipping point, where we're not going to be able to reverse the damage that's being done in the atmosphere and what's creating these insane weather patterns. So are they right? I don't know. I don't want to find out.
That's where I stand
on
it.
And that's why I'm saying if we went over as much as we could, take hundreds of billions of dollars instead of giving it away overseas and starting wars everywhere, and we're just talking again about putting billions of dollars more back into Iraq because, guess what? Al-Qaeda is taking over cities.
Fallujah has been completely taken over by a faction of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
What good did we do there? Oh, guess what? That's what we predicted. None!
Right. It's just horrible. What happened in the meantime, it drained our treasury, killed our soldiers, maimed them, and in an even larger numbers did that to the Iraqi people. But what we need is to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to get us off of oil, because that's the only reason that we're even over in the Middle East is for oil. And as much as we can, we should be talking about alternative fuels and not that slimy oil that's coming out of the United States now and out of Canada, which is so disastrous to ship. We just saw those trains explode a day or two ago.
Oh, yeah.
All right, but that's
terrible.
The
Explain
warnings are there, my
one,
friend.
Peter.
Thank you very much. What, the train?
Yeah,
it was one of those things. These this oil is being shipped by rail, and that's the one that exploded and killed, I don't know, what was it, 34 people in that Quebec City, Lac-Megantic, and this one blew up in North Dakota, and unfortunately, nobody was injured.
Right.
That was good. Hey,
so will that be the case the next time and the next time?
Well, no. They say, we should put it in a pipeline. And they guarantee it, this pipeline will not leak.
Yeah, they used to say CDs didn't scratch either.
They do?
Yes.
Okay.
to bloody hell, they scratch.
Yeah, they do. Listen, I want to get your call. Stay on the line. We don't have a phone screener. We just have you on hold. Jalene and I joke that this country has taken such a nosedive that we're no longer number one.
We're not really joking.
No, we're not joking. But, hey, we finally found something that of significance that the United States is number one in. And if you think there's other things, I mean, we're the richest country in the world, but we're also number one with the highest number of poor people in the industrialized world, and there's a connection. I mean, there's so many rich people, there's so many poor people because there's so many rich people. Right, it goes like that.
You've heard us say that a time or two.
Yeah, but here, in a world opinion poll, the United States is regarded as the number one biggest threat to world peace. Wait a minute, where are just these peaceful folks?
Why are we out there? Aren't we out there? Oh, wait, no, we're not out there making peace. We're invading countries based almost entirely on lies,
yeah,
and we're wreaking havoc on the world.
But wait a minute, this must have been taken by some left-wing poll group.
You always do this.
Wait a minute, no, by Gallup. They're actually very conservative.
They are.
They're very conservative. The poll sampled 1,000 people in 65 different countries, and so they polled almost 67,000 people. In aggregate terms, 20% of those polls thought the United States was the greatest threat to world peace today. The runner-up was Pakistan at 8%. China came in sixth, and North Korea and Iran all came in at 5%.
And we are ahead of them.
Well,
which means behind.
By 5 and 6%, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Nice company we keep, huh, Peter?
In Russia, 54% thought that the United States was the greatest threat to world peace. And even in a lot of countries that are our allies thought the same thing. Turkey and Greece, both NATO partners, 45% thought it the U.S. was the greatest threat to world peace. And let's see. This is from David Swanson. They're always a great website. DavidSwanson.com or .org. Anyway, he says, in the U.S., the greatest threat to peace on earth is a nation that hasn't, according to people in the United States, people in the United States were asked who was the greatest threat to peace. Well, naturally, people didn't say, yeah, it's us, right?
Right.
So the greatest threat to peace on earth is a nation that hasn't threatened any other and hasn't attacked any other in centuries, a nation that suffered horrible chemical weapons attacks, not they attacked anybody, but were attacked, and refused to use chemical weapons in response, a nation that has refused to develop nuclear weapons but has been falsely accused of doing so by the U.S. government for decades. That's right, a bit of laughable bad propaganda regurgitated in variations for 30 years, and the smart critical thinkers of the land of the free declare a nation with a military budget below 1% of our own, Iran, the greatest threat to world peace. Which is nuts.
There we go, it is nuts.
So you could say, well, why are you trash-talking our country, you know?
We're just reading from a poll.
Yeah, but here's the thing,
folks. But isn't it kind of true?
Yeah. Well, is it true? I mean, is the United States the greatest threat to world peace? And if not us, who is? We're the only country with overseas bases of any
800 of them to plus, 800 plus, Peter.
As I've always said, can you imagine if China had a South American command the way the United States does, or that China had a...
Or Russia.
Yeah, or Russia or some other country.
Or anyone.
Yeah, that has fought wars all over the world all the time, that there's barely been several years of peace, and yet we tell ourselves we're a peace-loving nation trying to establish democracy.
Please.
You know, I got to tell you, dear friends, that's never happened. It's never been the case.
That's right.
Know? Yeah.
Hey, Peter, I think we should take line two before we go to our break, and everyone else who's holding on. And no, this person doesn't know their line two, but you can usually tell in your ear that you're on the air.
You're okay. Hi, you're on the air. What's your first name in the city, and where are you calling from? That's the same thing.
Yeah.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Yep. My name is James. I'm from Shelby Township. How are you doing?
Okay,
hi, James.
Go ahead.
How are you doing, Peter?
Good, you're on the air.
Okay, actually, I was just calling to volunteer my services for... to take your partner home if she needed a ride. You could have buried in the station somewhere. Sorry, I only got one seat for.
I win, Peter. I have the proper parts.
All right, my friend, you have. Hey.
And I want to tell you whoever you are. You know, Peter didn't give you a chance to even hang on the line. He's see how fast he gets rid of you. I want to tell you. If I didn't think that Peter was going to get me home safely, which he will, I would be taking you up on that. I would make Peter stay on the air till 5 a.m.
Yeah. All right, my friend. Thank you very much.
I'm just kidding, Peter.
All right, let's go back to when we come back. Get your calls. And it's 248-544-WRIF. We're snowed in here at WRIF.
See, these men care about me.
They do. They do. They do. And what else? So we're a little discombobulated.
Well, it's a discombobulated kind of day.
Right. So we were saying that this global poll, people in the world think that the United States is the number one biggest threat to peace. What do you think? Do you think that's the deal? And
if not, I'd like to hear from the listeners. If you don't believe that we are, who is?
Yeah. All right.
Good question.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
I try to find the right one, but it seems like they all just have one thing on their mind.
Having only one thing on your mind can be a good thing when you find that special someone. At Geico.com, that someone is a car insurance policy, and the only thing on its mind is being your soulmate. Depend on easy online tools for paying bills and managing claims. Picture a life of savings as you gaze into the eyes of a free rate quote. That's our go-to move. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Hey, music lovers. Didn't find what you wanted under the tree? Hurry to Verizon to get the LG G2 for just $99.99. Verizon, click the banner to shop now. Requires new two-year activation. Early termination and other fees may apply.
Get everything that rocks on your smartphone. Dave and Chuck the Freak, The Rock Girl, The Riff Man Cave, and more. Oh, yeah, you can listen live, too. Download the 101 WRIF app for your iPhone or Android today from the App Store or Google Play Store. Brought to you in part by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Specs Howard's one-year programs in graphic design, broadcast, or digital media arts sharpen your creative edge. Find out more at SpecsHoward.edu or call 248-358-9000.
Jeez, Kim, it's hot as in here. What's going on?
Oh, it's only 91 degrees.
Where? In the refrigerator?
Ouch! The countertop is so hot you can fry eggs on it. And bacon and home fries. Are you on that sweat diet?
No.
I'm melting my life away.
Hey, by not running my air conditioner, I'm saving energy and helping the environment.
Uh-huh. There's an easier way to help the environment. Go green. Go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment, and you don't have to sweat it, if you know what I mean. So you got any eggs?
No.
How about shrimp? We can fry shrimp. Do you have any shrimp?
No. I have anchovies.
Mm-mm, no.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
All you ladies and gents out there enjoying the smooth sounds of the interwebs radio, Geico's got a special dedication to make. This one goes out to the inventors of the mouse. Because of you and your rodent-inspired design, people can click on over to Geico.com to pay their bills, manage their claims, and live lives of pure savings. Mouse Masters, you've clicked your way into our hearts for good. Enjoy this next song. It's going out to you. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. 248-544-WRIF. 248-544-9743. I haven't looked at the emails yet, but you can give it a shot and we'll take a look, read some of them on the air. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. And I don't know where Jalene. Oh, here's Jalene.
Right,
she's just joining us. And
I'm in a recovery process.
Yeah.
From
and our absolutely terrific program director, Mark Pennington,
Yay!
Is here. The driveway is now cleared?
It's in the process. They're banging it out. And I would say if you were plowing a radio station, that you'd probably tune in. So I want to say hello and thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And
thanks to the guy who offered to give me a ride home. Hey.
Mark's a great guy, but we don't have a phone screener. And I asked him, wait. I asked him, do you want to screen the calls?
Oh, you did not.
I did.
Peter, you need to. Oh, you're terrible.
And he looked at me and said, no.
You're awful.
All right, here's what we're talking about. A little about the weather. I mean,
oh, yeah,
why not?
And thank you to Mark, our boss, for offering to take me home, too, because we live kind of close to
That's
each
right.
other.
Yeah.
Closer than you and I.
This number one, this poll, rather, this global poll put together by Gallup, this kind of conservative polling agency, polled almost 70,000 people in 65 different countries, and the biggest threat to world peace by the majority of people was our country, United States.
We're also talking about climate change and this crazy snow we're experiencing, and it looks like line three has been holding for a while.
Okay.
You want to take that? I'm going to direct you on who's been holding longer.
Do that. You know, something, I don't think this is working, though, all of a sudden.
My peepers are better than yours.
No, isn't that what, oh, there you go. Okay. whoa, something new just came up, but let's see. Hi. Nope.
I think, did you accidentally hang up on them? I think you pressed the wrong button.
No, I didn't. Let's see. All right. Hey, it's WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Big B 420 from Detroit 420 show out here in California. Saying hi, Peter and Julie.
Welcome, California.
I'm surprised you're not in Colorado.
Oh, well, I have friends in Colorado. I'm getting ready to go there, but the prices are ridiculous. They want $400 an ounce out there now.
Wait, Peter and I don't know. What is it normally?
Well, right here in Michigan, it's usually around about $200 to $225 an ounce for medical marijuana.
Okay, let's...
And that's top...
Mm-hmm.
All right, let me stop you for 1 second. So I was going to introduce this subject anyways. That recreational marijuana has been made legal in Colorado, and here's the article, and I want to get your opinion just in a second. They lined up before dawn and in the snow on Wednesday. Baby boomers from Nebraska, retirees from Denver, and a young man who had driven all day from Ohio. Some were longtime users. Some had been arrested for marijuana possession. They were among the hundreds of tourists and residents across Colorado who eagerly took part in the country's first ever sales of state-regulated recreational marijuana.
There were lines around the block if you saw pictures of...
Yeah, there were 40 shops in downtown, from downtown Denver to snowy ski resorts. People flashed their identifications and in a single transaction took part in what supporters hailed as a historic departure from drug laws focusing on punishment and prohibition.
See, this is what we've been talking about, Peter. In all these years, we've been talking about medical, medicinal uses, things like that, in regard to marijuana. And the one thing we... have predicted, and that most people who kind of study the whole thing have predicted, is that the prices would go way up. Well, from what Big B, who we're not even let talk.
You get in a second.
what he said is it's basically doubled.
Yeah, to skeptics, it represents a grand folly. The governor and the Denver mayor both opposed legalization. What do you say? What do you think? Mistake?
Well, you know, the chances of getting to the kids, that's the worst thing we're afraid of right now. But, you know,
like the kids can't get it.
The kid can already get it. That's true. But, you know, we're worried about also this dabbing situation, too. I don't want to really get into it, but that might come up to bite it all.
Is that the wax stuff?
What situation?
Yeah, well, the dabs and the oils. See,
people
are using butane to make these things, and they're blowing themselves up. They're collapsing their lungs from too much use.
Yeah, that stuff is scary. I've read articles about it.
Yeah, and we're trying to make sure that everybody keeps it clean, and it can be cleaned properly, but you can't be doing this stuff in your kitchen. It has to be done on a medical grade in a situation and by a chemist and not by somebody that just wants to try to do it, and they can go and get all this material out there, you know, anywhere they want, at any place, and it's dangerous. So that's the only thing I'm really concerned in. You know, I never used to have to be a chemist 40 years ago when I started smoking marijuana.
You were more of a botanist, a horticulturist.
I'm a botanist. I grow, but I do make the dabs, and we do clean it up real good, and I personally don't smoke very much of that because it has a very hot, waxy, or, and it's really hard on your lungs. It makes you cough for at least 2 hours after you do one hit. And I just, I'm an old timer. I'm old school. I like the taste of a nice doobie. But most of the time, my big right. But anyway, I just want to say one thing about the weather, if you give me 1 minute.
Sure.
You know, when I was a kid, I grew up in Michigan. I grew up in Romeo, Michigan, graduated from Romeo High School in 1969. Yeah. Anyway, so I remember 5 foot drifts, you know, all the time, 5 feet of snow all the way around all the time in places where you couldn't even get into unless you had a snowmobile. So, yeah, you know, it was a lot different back there, and the weather has drastically changed. But, you know, this is the first year that I've spent so much time out here in California because I did the West Coast Grow for everybody to show everybody it can be done in their own closet and they can survive very well, you know, being self-sufficient.
Well,
stay in the closet.
Yeah, stay in the closet. But you're right. The winters used to be very, very severe. And now, you know, for the last, I don't know, 3-4 winters, there's hardly been enough snow to do any cross-country skiing on.
Oh, Peter, it all comes back to your exercising, doesn't it? No wonder you look so
good. Thank you, my friend. Here, the New York Times, the editorial board has an editorial in today's paper, The Marijuana Experiment. And actually, one of their columnists, David Brooks, who's their resident conservative, he naturally talked about smoking weed when he was a young man. And
well, at least he admits
the experiment. Well, now, remember, we always used to say, we used to experiment with marijuana, and
it was a success.
Yeah, anyway, here's what they're concerned about, the fate of the black market. One of the basic arguments in favor of legalization is that it could eliminate the black market and create new tax revenue. But just what Big B was saying, it's not clear how quickly and to what extent this will actually happen. And marijuana sold at retail shops that pay taxes may well cost more than illegal marijuana, potentially keeping off the books dealers in business.
And that now we have proof that it has doubled.
And that's what he said, their next thing was underage smoking, so they're concerned. The Justice Department said it was not going to sue states that are legalizing marijuana because of a federal law against possession of marijuana. You have to have a marijuana stamp tax.
Yeah, but who gets
marijuana
those?
Tax stamp.
Now, at this point, when they're legalizing it, such as in Colorado, the tax stamp actually makes sense. Before that, it didn't make sense because who's in their right mind who is buying or selling something that's illegal going to go and sign up for a tax stamp?
There you go.
Come on.
But as it is, roughly 36% of 12th graders reported having used marijuana in 2013. So a third of our teenagers are already.
Hmm.
And, hey, you know what? There's another thing. What's that other intoxicant called?
Good old alcohol.
Booze. Yeah, right. So some kids do that. So they're banning marijuana ads near schools, libraries, and playgrounds. Why couldn't you have marijuana ads near libraries? Oh, because kids go there.
Yeah,
right. I was thinking like, I'm going to smoke a doobie and then go read some, you know, epistemological philosophy.
Some what?
I don't know. I don't even know what it means.
Oh, sure you do.
They want to stem the flow of marijuana across state lines. Colorado has imposed different rules on residents and visitors. Residents may buy up to an ounce per transaction, but visitors only a quarter ounce.
That's what they tried doing in Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah, right. They did. But here, a big question is whether the widespread of availability of marijuana will lead to decreased alcohol consumption, which recent research suggests might happen. So that would be good.
It would be interesting to see.
The vast majority of alcohol consumption, I don't have the figures here, is done by about a third of the people.
Oh, okay.
I mean, a lot of people do not drink at all, ever.
My mate, he doesn't drink alcohol. He's never done anything in his life. Honestly, if he has, I've seen him drink one beer. We've been together for 2 years, and yes, we're still on the air. Why don't we take another phone call?
Yeah. Let me see. That could be a boon for public health. heavy drinking. Imagine this now in the New York Times. Why didn't the New York Times say this 30 or 40 years ago before we spent, now get the T in this word, the $1 trillion on the war on drugs, which was really just a war on our citizens that fueled crime, that created this explosion of prisons.
It created, I was going to say, the big business and under the prison industrial complex that has just, like you said, exploded. Our jails are filled. Our prisons are filled with nonviolent offenders, people who, sold a bag of something and off they go.
Yeah. All right, let's take another call. We don't have a phone screener. Just tell me who you are. Your first name only,
please. We do have a phone screener, but he has the night off because it's horrendous.
And someone else who won't take on the task. He's not listening, is he?
I don't know who you're talking about. Mark, leave him alone.
He's
the greatest.
He is the greatest. He's here.
You're a smarty pants.
He's here.
You like to test him. You like to test these authority.
Middle of a snowstorm. All right. Okay.
I apologize for him, Mark.
Okay. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. What's your first name? Where are you calling from?
Oh, Peter, Julie. This is Ron from Shelby Township.
Hey, Ron.
How you doing, Ron?
Yeah, I just want to make a comment on the snow guy that said talking about all this screwy weather in the last couple of years. Well, the screwy weather we've had in the last couple of years, it all has to do with the chemtrails. There's no doubt.
I figured. But tell people what chemtrails are.
Can you turn your radio down?
Ron.
Turn your radio down.
Oh, I don't have my radio on, I don't think.
No, I don't think you are because we're getting this direct echo.
Okay, it's off.
Okay.
Freaking me out, man.
Am I all right?
Yeah, you're fine.
I'm not.
You'll have to answer that.
Chemtrails, most people don't know, chemtrails, they're actually spraying in the upper atmosphere. What they're spraying is aluminum dust because they have found out that aluminum reflects 4 times the amount of sunlight back out into outer space. And the whole idea of them spraying these chemtrails is to reduce the temperature of the Earth.
Okay. Let me stop you right there. There's a little bit of a conspiracy-ish feeling to this.
Why do they want to do that?
To cool the planet down. And that's what they're doing. There's witnesses all across the country that witness these chemtrails, and all over the country.
I know some people who are concerned about chemtrails.
Yeah, all you have to do is look up in the sky.
You would think that they were just the...
That's called the airplane.
The jet exhaust. One of the things that...
But I'll tell you what, if those chemtrails do turn out to be the real deal, I'm gonna eat my words there, Ron. Okay.
Hey, but Ron, I want to ask you something. I was thinking about this. I said this after you were off the air last week when you were saying that that Barack Obama's father was not actually the Kenyan guy, was this American who you identified as a communist, and he certainly was close to a lot of communist groups, right?
Yeah. Well, his real father.
Peter, why did you bring this?
I
want to
ask him something. Okay, his real father was, what's his name, Marshall?
Frank Marshall Davis.
Frank Marshall Davis. All right. So let's say that Frank Marshall Davis was, in fact, Barack Obama's father, and, in fact, that Frank Marshall Davis was a communist. What does that tell us about Barack Obama?
Well, he grew up studying communism. Frank Marshall Davis was investigated starting in 1947.
That's right.
Investigated for 17 years by the FBI, and the FBI has like 600 pages on him.
Well,
my dad's a Republican, and no one accuses me of being a Republican.
Yeah, so that's what I was saying.
And how can you put something on someone just because of this imaginary father?
But,
is crazy.
Here, during that period of the, going back pretty far, but particularly as J. Edgar Hoover's power grew in the FBI, they began investigating any number of people that were for civil rights or for the labor movement mm-hmm. or for civil liberties. So
the
when,
pot stirrers.
Yeah. So one of the things under the Freedom of Information Act and under this disclosures that came as a result of lawsuits in Michigan, New York, California, lots of places, that anybody that tried to make any change whatsoever during that period had this enormous file on them. Okay.
Peter has one.
Yeah, I had one, too.
And you know what? It's not a conspiracy that J. Edgar Hoover was a cross-dresser. Okay, there you
all
go.
All right, thank you. Well, listen, the J. Edgar Hoover FBI building, remember we used to say that? It's the only government building named after a transvestite.
I know.
Yeah, so
it's
we ought to give him a few props.
Remember we walked by it one time when we were in D.C. and we got a good little giggle.
What do we do?
That.
We were there for the counter-inaugural in...
But we were there for the Union Cap Convention.
Oh, was it?
Mm-hmm. We were there for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
We've been to D.C. a lot.
But you, I remember you, it was winter. You were standing in front of the Supreme Court building.
Yeah, I went to the counter-inaugural for the second Bush election.
Really? No. It was 2004. Yeah, that probably was.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
They put us in our little pen of naughty people.
But, oh, that was when we were working for the UAW, the national show?
I think that...
But 2005...
It was after that.
It would have been 2005.
Would have
been 2005.
Let's talk about our personal business on the ride, long ride home.
All right. Someone, why didn't we ever write this all down?
Take line one, Peter. They've been holding the longest. No, wait, line two.
I was going to do that. All right, 248-544-WRIF. No one really wants to address the question of this international poll of almost 70,000 people that overwhelmingly says the United States is the greatest threat to world peace.
Maybe everyone agrees.
Maybe everybody agrees. Here in the United States, we all think it's Iran. But Iran, I mean, think about this. The United States has been fighting two wars on the border of Iran.
Oh, my gosh.
That generally tends to piss other countries off.
Make them a little nervous. Maybe want, make them want to hang on to these nukes. And...
Yeah, what if Iran was fighting a war in Canada and Mexico?
Oh, boy.
That's the same
Tables
thing.
Turn, huh?
Yeah, they're not nice, and we are. All right.
Oh, my.
Hi, you're on the air. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Paul. Hi, this is Paul. I'm calling from San Francisco. I think it's snowing in where you are.
You would be right, my friend. How are you?
I used to live in Lansing.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Michigander, you understand.
Yeah, I lived in a bunch of cities around there. But so what do you think? Is climate change really happening to Michigan? Because we're having a drought in California, and we're expecting to become the next Sahara Desert here.
Oh, great. Listen, at some point, you have to take experts who you respect. We can't do
hundreds
the science.
Hundreds and hundreds yeah. of the top scientists in this country around
the world agree.
Say that climate change is real.
I'm just going to go out
on a limb and say I believe them.
Yeah, and not just, but also human caused by the activity of fossil fuel burning. And as I said, why wouldn't we want to stop as much pollution as possible? You know who's behind a lot of this? This is these Koch brothers, these two brothers, David and what's the other one's name? The famous one is
why
David.
Why do I forget?
Yeah, but the two of them, I mean, they never worked a day in their life. They got all their, they inherited all their money, and if the two...
And they started the Tea Party.
Yeah.
We can thank them. Thank you.
They have. They finance all this anti-climate change research, and guess what they own? Power companies.
Yes.
Yeah, energy companies.
And that's conspiracy.
If you took the money that the two Koch brothers have and combined it, they would be one person. They would be the second richest person in the world. So why in the world? I don't understand this. If they had billions, I forgot what their fortune is put together. Say it's a measly 20 or 30 billion. Which
okay.
That wouldn't make them number two in the world for sure. But or say they had 60, 70 billion dollars, or the Waltons, who together have 120 billion dollars.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they say, I got an idea, let's take $100 billion of our money and convert the entire United States to
green energy.
Green energy. And we would still have $20 billion. Oh, man, what do we do with $20
billion? What would you do, you poor baby?
Let's do it all, except we'll stick with $1 billion. And they could still have their art museums that Alice Walton's putting together. They could still have all their homes. They could still control everything.
They
could still buy all the politicians. And yet, they could get us off this poisonous substance. And people would sing their praises. They would erect statues to them rather than revile them, right?
Yeah.
All right, my friend. Boy. Thank you very much.
They
appreciate
don't think,
your call.
Unfortunately, they're never going to think that way. You know what? One of those brothers is going to take a fall. There's going to be some kind of really dirty sex scandal or something that they've been in brothels or something. Because usually men with power like
that
power of those of that magnitude.
I've never seen much about their personal lives. Actually,
because it's probably very, very dirty.
Okay. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you at 248-544-WRIF. Let's take another call. Hi, your first name, please, in the city you're calling from. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm Tim. I'm calling from Snowed In Lincoln Park.
Hey, Tim. Tim has been calling this show for such a long time. I don't even want to think about it.
Forever.
How long, Tim? Do the math. Don't let Peter do it.
It's been at least back into the 20th century.
Yeah.
That's okay.
A long time.
Yeah. But go ahead, Tim. You're on the air.
I want to talk about global warming. I mean, if people still want to believe Obama was born in Kenya, they're welcome to it, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that dog don't hunt.
And it's not going to change anything.
Yeah. But this thing about global warming, okay, now, I think people confuse what is called weather and what is called climate. Now, weather is what we see day to day.
Like this, yeah.
Like this. So you're going to have your snow, you're going to have your rain, you're going to have whatever you're going to have. Now, the global warming, that's actually, as we know, that's actually the warming of the atmosphere overall of the whole planet.
Right.
And that's been found by scientists, you know, who have like various weather stations around the world, and they measure these things called greenhouse gases. The prominent one is CO2, which comes out of cars, comes out of coal plants, comes out of, even like the way we use electricity and stuff like that. And so, but in the atmosphere getting warmer, what is found is since the atmosphere is treated as a fluid by a lot of these computational models, the temperatures can vary drastically from weather cycle to weather cycle. So you might, for example, get like really low temperatures. You might get floods in various places, and you might get more dry spells. But the overall effect is a warming effect. So we shouldn't be, you know, fooled about, okay, now it's getting colder for a couple of months, therefore global warming doesn't exist. I mean, that's just, it even could be effect of global warming, actually.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, these fluctuations. And I don't know. I guess I can't do much more than advocate erring on the side of caution, so that if we were wrong, still we did something to reduce. We're not burning gasoline.
Emissions.
We're not burning coal. What?
You guys were saying that okay, you have to be an expert to follow a lot of this stuff. But I mean, there are scientific magazines like Scientific American. You don't have to really. All you need is a high school education, so you can kind of go read it for yourself. Now, if you think the data in the magazine is real, then you can just kind of follow the graph and then figure out, okay, this thing is trending upward. It's getting warmer and warmer. So, yeah. You know, you don't have to be a professional scientist
right.
I think, to get it.
In other words, just dig a little deeper than just hearsay or what you're hearing.
Yeah, because all the
news
people that are preaching against this, I mean, they have big oil money behind this. So they're going to put up all these fake institutes and fake data. They're going to say, well, it's not real.
A lot of propaganda.
Well, it's not, they, oftentimes the media, because they're afraid of the ultra-rich and their news media, the news outlets are owned by the ultra-rich, they want to present it as still it's a debate. You know, one side says there's global warming, pardon me, the other side says it isn't. Well, there's no respect for the side that says there isn't.
Yeah, the industries, the big industries, the coal industry, power industry, all of that. And let's not leave out our good friends, the lobbyists.
Yeah. Hey, Tim, I got to go because I got to do a little bit of our commercial business before we hit the new or the midnight hour. So thank you, and always enjoy talking with you. And we'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
All you ladies and gents out there enjoying the smooth sounds of the interwebs radio, Geico's got a special dedication to make. This one goes out to the inventors of the mouse. Because of you and your rodent-inspired design, people can click on over to Geico.com to pay their bills, manage their claims, and live lives of pure savings. Mouse Masters, you've clicked your way into our hearts for good. Enjoy this next song. It's going out to you. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Hey, music lovers. Didn't find what you wanted under the tree? Hurry to Verizon to get the LG G2 for just $99.99. Verizon, click the banner to shop now. Requires new two-year activation. Early termination and other fees may apply.
What is graphic design?
Graphic design informs.
It is the thread seen throughout advertising.
Graphic design persuades.
It is everywhere from logos to websites.
Graphic design organizes.
It is the organization of content and art.
Graphic design stimulates.
It markets to an audience.
Graphic design attracts attention.
Spex Howard School of Media Arts teaches the foundation skills to begin attracting attention of your own. Through layouts, visual arts, typography, web, and print design, Specs Howard prepares you for today's industry. There are just a few seats left in the graphic design class starting in January, so start the new year right by enrolling today. Call 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000 to make an appointment or visit SpecsHoward.edu.
Our son would go from "Good morning, Mom" to words you'd never expect to come out of your child's mouth. Our pain came from not knowing what to do. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. 5 or 6 years later, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. I think the hardest part of living with someone who has a mental illness is thinking that you're alone, that no one else could understand. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is made up of people who live it every day. We lean on each other, and we learn from each other. NAMI doesn't let anyone give up hope. My name is Mary Tadikin, and I can tell you what NAMI has meant for my family. It has meant that we are a family.
1 in 5 adults lives with depression, schizophrenia, anxiety, or other mental illnesses. NAMI provides education and support to these families and individuals. To find a local chapter, go to NAMI.org or call 800-950-NAMI.
I try to find the right one, but it seems like they all just have one thing on their mind.
Having only one thing on your mind can be a good thing when you find that special someone. At Geico.com, that someone is a car insurance policy, and the only thing on its mind is being your soulmate. Depend on easy online tools for paying bills and managing claims. Picture a life of savings as you gaze into the eyes of a free rate quote. That's our go-to move. Geico, 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Tickets for Nitro Circus, January 12th at the Palace, and maybe a shot at racing our Riff Rock girl, Lindsay. Learn more online at WRIF.com.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Ritz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIN.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour, 248-544-WRIF. Why are you looking at me so strangely?
You're just so darn cute, Peter. 248-544-9743.
Check out my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Also, we're on Facebook. I'm looking at it right now. And Jolene posted, my co-host will be here in a little while. Despite this, the snow, the show must go on.
Yeah.
Join us tonight at 11 Eastern on Riff. So you did that. Thank you. My guest at 1 a.m., an incredible guy, Thaddeus Russell, who is a historian, and he wrote this book called A Renegade History of the United States. And he talks about how American history was shaped by those who are considered to be the lower orders, like bums and
peasantry,
peasants and prostitutes. And you got to hear this guy. He's incredible.
Well, we may have a lengthy ride home. Yeah. If we get stuck into the snow, we can just listen to
there
ourselves.
You go. And also Bruce Levine, who is an incredible, I think, I don't know whether he is a psychiatrist. I think he's a psychologist. And he writes in his book, Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, How to Find More Morale, Energy, and Community in a World Gone Crazy. And he says a lot of the emotional difficulties that people experience are understandable reaction to what confronts all of us in the world today.
In the modern world, yeah. And that it's not necessarily just, it's not just you.
An individual failing,
yes.
Or why am I anxious, or why am I depressed?
Yeah.
I mean, man, makes a lot of sense.
Because I know that oftentimes when people are depressed, they think, you know, what is wrong with
me? Yeah.
And then they further, they're depressed, and then they further tear themselves down. It's just a vicious cycle. So this will be a very interesting interview. We do have a couple of open lines for the first time. Are you squeaking again, Peter?
I don't think so.
For the first time since we started the show tonight. So if you were unable to get through before, you can give it a shot now. But we do have a few people standing by.
Do we have, does Greater Media have a station in San Francisco? Here's our third, our third call. I knew that. Our third caller, our third caller from San Francisco.
We have a strong following.
You're on the air. You're calling from San Francisco?
Yes, and you are on the internet. That's how we hear you out here.
Well, that's great.
We are at WRIF.com.
Right.
The point is that, like, you have to talk about solutions if you're going to talk about climate change. And there was a big article in the Rolling Stone with Bill McKibben, but in it there's no solutions discussed. And probably the most important solution is coming out of Europe, where they have this thing called a feed-in tariff, which requires the utilities to pay like 54 cents a kilowatt hour for harvest, anybody that harvests solar energy. And there's one city over in Germany, it's a little farming village, that produces 333% more solar energy than it uses. And as a result, the farmers last year sold the energy and made $6 million.
Wow.
One small village, and it's got a wild name. It's Wild, WILDPOLDSRIED.
Wild.
And I can't pronounce that in German. But
oh, hey, what's your first name again? I'm sorry.
Paul.
Oh, you didn't say. All right, Paul, you can do that here in Michigan.
DTE will buy your energy if you create extra solar energy.
With wind or solar.
You can sell it back to them.
Yeah.
So
they're required by law.
Yeah.
Kilowatt hour?
Yeah.
Will they pay you 54 cents a
kilowatt
hour?
I don't know how much it is.
I don't think it's that high.
No.
You don't have a feed-in tariff in Michigan. You
know
that?
A what?
A what?
You don't have a feed-in tariff.
Feed-in
tariff. Okay.
The utilities to pay you. It's not a state thing. It's the utilities must pay. And some TV station in Berlin went out and asked tenants, what do you think of having to pay $20 a year extra for solar energy? And this one tenant said, $20 a year? Well, I pay $20 a month extra for beer. I spend $20 a month on beer. Why would I worry about $20 a month a year if we can get rid of nukes and ban fracking? And Germany has banned fracking using the feed-in tariff because they produced, last year, they produced 50% of their energy during the month of May.
Well, and also
so many of those European countries are so far ahead of anywhere.
And Germany is getting rid of nukes. I mean, if they're still talking about siting.
And let's talk about genetically modified organisms. In a lot of countries in Europe, they have rejected and said no GMOs. But we are all big business here. It's all GMOs. Even though General Mills announced that Cheerios, just the regular ones, not the. They have 8 million kinds of Cheerios now, but Cheerios, they are going GMO
free. Yeah.
Because
I didn't know anything about Cheerios.
Because I just read it the other day from a credible source. And why are you looking at me that way?
I was just stretching. I was just stretching. I wasn't doing anything. Paul, you know, one thing you said about solutions, I have friends in Detroit that used to call themselves revolutionaries, and now they call, get this, solutionaries. How's that?
That's good.
I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so what do you think about a feed-in tariff? Would you
a feed-in tariff? I'm all for anything that will force us off of the addiction to fossil fuels. Is good for all of us, good for our health, and good for the planet. All right, hey Paul, thanks
for
joining us, and thanks for being our third caller today.
There's a book about it called Energy Imperative.
Who wrote it? Maybe I'll do an interview with
Herman Scheer. a 29-year-old kid in Germany. He's the guy that wrote the law in Germany. And the book is called Energy Imperative, and it's by Hermann Scheer. And there's a movie about it. It's a free movie on YouTube called Here Comes the Sun, Hermann Scheer. And it's a free movie on YouTube about how Germany has switched to solar and wind. It's an amazing movie.
Maybe we can post it. Huh, Jelena, are you writing it down?
I am, as we speak.
All right, Paul, thanks for joining us from one of our favorite cities, San Francisco.
Oftentimes it takes the younger generations, and it's going to take these younger generations to create this change. So when it's startling to hear that a 29-year-old created this law in a country in Europe and was successful at getting that done. I love that. We have hope because of the youth. We need our young people.
And we do. And we could use some callers right now because we have open lines for you. Finally, at 248-544-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. What's your first name, please, in the city you're calling from? Are you with me?
Hello?
Hi.
Hello, hi. Sorry, we don't have a phone screener, so we're just taking you cold off the... What's your first name? Where are you calling from?
Well, it's Fred from Detroit.
Okay, welcome.
Hi, Fred.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm warm and laying in bed.
Good.
Oh, good.
Yeah, shoveled snow a couple hours ago, and I guess it's back down, but I'm not going to worry about it until the sun comes up.
There you go.
Well, I called back because I had a comment on the global warming thing, and then I had another one on us being so scary to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
As far as global warming is concerned, I heard of a program on PBS, actually NOVA, you know, scientific, and they were doing a thing on volcanoes, and they were saying how all the pollution we put into the air is going to exacerbate the next big volcanic eruption. You know, all that sulfuric gas and everything that comes up periodically, you know, every 100 or so years, wherever in the world, pollution is going to make things a lot worse as far as breathing, as far as climate change, you know, to the point of cooling the planet down, because we've seen that with that eruption in the Philippines.
Right.
Not long ago, we had the whole aircraft thing a couple of years ago over Iceland. You know, shut down airports.
Oh, yeah. That, remember, there was this volcanic eruption, it disrupted air travel. You couldn't see it.
And weren't those ashes,
were they
in California? Didn't they reach all the way to the United States?
Right. Things get up into the jet stream and they go around the world. You know, pollution from a Russian steel mill will rain acid rain in a forest in New Hampshire.
It's crazy.
Or DDT that they're using on cotton in Mexico will wind up killing stuff on Isle Royale in the middle of Lake Superior.
Wow.
Yeah. So Yeah, I mean, we've been poisoning the planet for a couple hundred years with industrialism.
Well, especially since the Industrial Revolution, when all of those, now millions and millions of new chemicals have been introduced since that.
And tons that go into the atmosphere. And a lot of this stuff doesn't go away, which is the problem, right?
Right. And, you know, when we forget, you know, during our short lifespans about the disastrous natural cycles of this planet, earthquakes, which, you know, I'm starting to hear more about out there in fracking country,
sure,
in the middle of the country, you know, and like I was just saying, you know, volcanic eruptions. And just because we haven't had a huge earthquake since maybe San Francisco in 1906 or whatever, you know, these things will come around, and they're going to break oil pipelines, they're going to do all sorts of disastrous things.
When will people wake up? When will everybody wake up?
Well,
as long as the big business is snowing people with commercials that say coal is clean. They call it clean coal technology. That is the biggest oxymoron I've ever heard in my life.
Well, I'll tell you, Fred and Jelena, I was giving a talk. I can't even remember what it was on, but someone said to me, what is it going to take for people to wake up about what's happening to the environment? And I said, this isn't very pretty, but it's going to take a major catastrophe.
Yep.
That's what it is.
And I it already is. I mean, what happened in the Philippines.
It's a slow catastrophe.
If anyone really has a grasp on how huge that was, just awful.
A typhoon.
That's just awful.
Yeah. All right, Fred, hey, stay warm.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Fred. And I want to say thanks to Polly for writing in. She said, Forbes says, we were talking about the Koch brothers and the amount of wealth they have. Charles Koch is the other one that we found out.
David and Charles.
Charles Koch has at least $36 billion. David Koch has at least $36 billion as well. So between them, they have at least $72 billion.
So there's only...
Thanks, Polly.
There's only one guy richer, and that is Senor Slim.
Oh, yes, Senor Slim.
In Mexico. Yeah.
See.
Yeah. But, hey, if one of the Waltons had all the money, they would be richer than, they wouldn't be richer than Slim and the Koch brothers put together. But close, $120 billion between two of them. How did they get that much money?
I mean, what's a billion or two between friends?
Well, yeah, the Waltons, of course, get it by ripping off people all over the world in terms of paying them just terrible wages. All right, let's take another call, and our number is 248-544-WRIF, some open lines for you. And hi, you're on the air. What's your first name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, my name's Kyle. How are you?
Hey, Kyle. Thanks for calling. We're great.
Hey, I just want to say, I'm an Iraqi vet. I've been home a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, my whole platoon, 22232, was hit by an IED.
Oh.
And I lost both my legs. And I just want to say that I think that everybody out there, all you people, I know this is hard times right now, but I'm trying to learn now how to walk without legs, and I see my platoon blew apart, and I just wonder what, I'm just trying to wonder why.
Well, I think
I still don't understand it.
Okay. First of all, there are organizations like some of these Iraqi war
veterans groups, which I hope
groups.
You're in touch with.
Do you have? Are you on the computer ever?
No, I have no access to nothing.
Okay.
I'm battle born. I just come back. Nobody wants to talk to me.
Okay, here's what we're going to do right now. I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to go in the other room. I'm going to get your information, and we are going to put you in touch with some organizations that can help you, because those are the organizations that we know about, and we've helped people before. You are not alone. There are organizations that will help you, whether it be transportation or, psychological counseling that I believe every vet needs, especially when someone's gone through what you've gone through.
And if there are other vets listening and have some advice, give
us
a call as well. All right, so we're going to put you on hold.
And I'm going to go in the other room and talk to you. I'll be right there.
Okay, and hopefully I've done that right. I don't know. I actually don't even know what you can say after you hear that. But the next time, whoever it is, President whoever, start saying we're going off to war somewhere in Asia or the Middle East or South America, just get out there with all the people and say, no, we're not doing that again to our young men and women. We're not going to do that to the people in those other countries. And think about this guy. And we live in a country ostensibly that takes care of their veterans, the victims of Bush's war based on lies. And yet in these countries like Iraq, like Afghanistan, people suffer these kind of wounds and get little or no attention. All right. Jalene says call back.
John,
call back, will you? All right, let's, we're going to, I guess, go to another. We don't have a phone screener here. Stuck at home because of the snow. We're here taking your calls at 248-544-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. What's your first name? Where are you calling from?
My name is Dan.
Hi, Dan.
From Livonia, Michigan.
Welcome. Welcome to the program.
So anyway, I was reading online that the Death Valley National Park in California has suspended all cycling and running activities. And the reason is the fear of the dust particles that are radioactive from the Fukushima plant that was involved in the earthquake in Japan.
What?
And I don't know if...
That, you know, I know this stuff we were talking about gets in the jet stream, sure. And, you know, all this radioactive junk is floating across the Pacific right now. They might think that miles of this stuff might hit the Washington, Oregon, California coast. But actually, radioactive particles in the air have made a valley in the United States unbreathable?
Well, it's because of the aerobic activity. The athletes are going to be consuming so much oxygen, and they feel that it could be at levels that will be harmful to their health. And,
wow.
And now the Park Service has not said anything
about that. Are you talking about Fukushima?
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is true.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know all about this. Go
wow.
ahead.
Wow, go ahead. Sorry.
So the Park Service, on their notification, they don't say anything specific about the radioactivity, but they are suspending the bike activities and the running activities for 2014.
Yo.
And I would just like to think that this should be on national news.
Well, if I missed it, which, and I'm pretty diligent.
Well, we go pretty in-depth.
Yeah, and I missed it, but apparently Jalene did not.
Yeah, Peter, for once, I'm going to send you some information.
Okay.
How about that?
Yeah. Well, this, you know, the wake-up call does not seem to be widespread enough. And a lot of people know it, but part of it is they don't know how to respond. I mean, we're fortunate, Jalene and I are, and you folks as well, to call and make our opinions known, but it's kind of going off into the air. I mean, it's good to get the ideas, it's good to get the information, but at some point, it's got to take place in the world where decisions are being made. And I don't mean to diminish what we're doing or what you're telling us. Very important that you called in with this. But we have to be, as we were saying, solutionaries. And it has to be in a form that has power behind it. Because who has power behind it now are the earth poisoners, the people that want more nuke plants, some in this country, the people that want to keep us on coal, the people that want to keep burning oil and fighting wars for oil, shedding blood for oil, like that call from John. And most of us feel, the system's been engineered like this. Every 4 years or so, sometimes every 2 years, but most people every 4 years, we get called out to make our choice between Tweedledee and Tweedledummer. And between 2000 and 2008, we had Tweedledummer. Now we have Tweedledee, but people are probably dissatisfied with him. And in 2016, we'll say, well, let's try Tweedledummer again. And, you know, it'll be like Ron Paul or somebody like that. I don't know. Well, all right.
One last thing.
Sure, sure.
I'm 47, and I've been listening to your show since I was 17.
Wow.
And I've always been an avid bicyclist. And I remember when I was a teenager, I asked you what bike you rode. I heard, and back then you rode a Vetus.
He still has it.
Shimano 600 group set.
Yeah, well, you know what? I have the same bike. You know, it looks like it's ready for the bike antique, but it gets my butt around. And I added a few Campagnola. I can't remember now. I think it's got a Campy derailleur. But, I used to ride with the Wolverine Sport Club. And now I look at the bikes that people are riding. And the amount of money that they cost, and it's amazing. But I just got a new set of wheels last summer because I needed them. Because the aluminum had eroded so badly that the rims had gotten actually holes in it. The aluminum had oxidized, which I didn't even know it could. I thought that's why people had aluminum.
The Venus is comfortable. It's a comfortable bike.
Yeah.
All you got to do is get a good handlebar and a good seat on, and you're good to go.
Yeah,
a lot of the riders chase speed with buying bikes, but it's mainly your fitness level.
It is.
How you eat, how flexible you are. You could be on an old bike from the 80s, and you can still kick butt against someone, if you work at it.
Yeah, that's right. It is. Keeps me in shape. I love to do it. Hey, great talking to you. Thanks for calling.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. 248-544-WRIF is our phone number, and let's take this call. Hi, you're on the air. What's your first name? Where are you calling from?
This is Jim from Utica.
Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Yeah, what I'm calling about is a little bit of the environmental stuff here in Michigan.
Sure.
And what I always found was really weird was that here in Michigan we have, short of Alaska, I believe, we have the biggest coastline, and 20% of the world's fresh water.
Yeah.
But we import and make profit from importing Canada's garbage.
Yep.
And putting in our own landfills.
That's right.
It's just complete insanity.
No, that just never made any sense to me, and that goes across the board from Democrats, Republicans, whatever governor, mm-hmm. whatever governor we've had, probably since I can remember back since Milliken. And I just can't figure out why we do that. And
money.
With these lakes,
yeah.
Well, absolutely, money. But people that have, you know, a couple brain cells still rubbing together can figure out, you know what? We got to drink something. We've got this wonderful freshwater system around us. We should be protecting it the most.
You know where Georgian Bay is? Speaking of that, you know where Georgian Bay is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just how would you describe it to non Detroit, non-Michigan listeners. It's up north and east of Lake Huron, and it's the largest body of drinkable water in the world. And I've been up there, actually this was about 10 years ago now, and I remember I was on this boat going out to this island called Flower Pot Island, and the captain just put his cup into the Georgian mm-hmm. Bay and drank it. And I'm thinking, right. Wow, that's great, although I wouldn't do it.
No way.
Right.
And that's the way it should be.
About, and again, talking with the vastness of that, windmills out in the lakes even.
Hmm.
The wind's constantly blowing. You go out by Port Huron.
Sure.
That's true.
You go to St. Marie. You go on the west side over by Ludington. Traverse City. Boom.
Yeah, anytime you get near a large body of water, it tends to be windy.
Right. It's huge and open.
Well, the other thing, some of the people that, for some reason or other, are conservatives and they want to conserve our dependence on fossil fuels say it's not possible to have enough alternative energy to power what we're powering today. Well, you know what?
Why don't we give it a shot?
And also, why don't we power down a little? Right?
Yeah.
We just don't have to have as much energy usage as there is. In fact, what did I see? What car company was just coming out with a solar-powered car? I mean, they've done these with these little cars at the University of Michigan Engineering School and what have you. But we may be at a point, and it's hard for people to get their mind around, as you're talking about, to rub those brain cells together. And then if you can, and if you come to the conclusion and you want to be a solutionary, what is open for one to actually bring about a solution? It's pretty tough. I mean, there's groups out there. There's groups like Don't Waste Detroit and the Sierra Club, and yet there's not this mass entrance into them that could have real political power. That could make the politicians hop too, because who's making the politicians hop too are the Koch brothers and Mobil Oil and Exxon Mobil.
Well,
and
the almighty dollar just speaks. It doesn't speak; it screams.
Yeah. What did Bob Dylan sing? Money doesn't talk; it swears.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right, my friend. Thank you very much. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. No, and the last thing again, it brings me back to why is Michigan importing trash?
Yeah, well.
That is a really good question, other than money.
We have so much to offer.
Hey, let's go back one step. Why are we generating so much trash? That's where we got to begin. And we got to get rid of these plastics. Most of that stuff is not recyclable. The stuff that is recyclable.
Styrofoam is not.
Yeah. With this stuff that is shipped to, you know, huge container ships filled with shredded milk cartons that go to China, that go in these factories that are absolute disasters for the environment.
And the workers.
And the workers. And then they make some horrible piece of plastic crap that then they ship back to the United States, and then the second generation cannot be recycled at all, so then it's got to be landfilled. You know, E.E. Cummings is an American poet. I know one line from his poetry.
I know none, so lay it on me.
Okay. I don't want to startle you, but they mean to kill us all.
Oh, I do know that one because I've heard you say it.
Any number of times, yeah. So that's what we got to look at. Our lives, our future are on the line, and we have to, you know, did we just stand here? I mean, one of the things, maybe it is an inappropriate analogy. Because people that have, I was thinking of the Holocaust, that the people that did nothing. And there a lot of folks don't like the use of the Holocaust as an analogy for
in
anything.
In any way, shape, or form.
But think about the people that knew what was going on and did nothing. And this now is not about it happening to other people. It is happening to us, no matter whether we're rich or poor or liberal or conservative or whatever.
You know what's really scary? Well, that's scary enough, but have you seen the images captured in the ocean of these giant floating garbage dumps?
They're heading towards, I was saying, you were, I think, out of the room. They're radioactive, coming from Fukushima.
Well, that, but I've seen other ones, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's all bad, and especially this radiation. My gosh, Peter.
There's a name for it. What of the debris? Maybe they're just junk islands or something.
There is a name for it, but I can't remember.
There is. They estimate that there are a million... I said this to my wife. She said, who's counting? I don't know. But they estimate that there are a million styrofoam cups thrown into the ocean every single day.
Ugh. The first time I saw that image, it made me sick to my stomach.
Yeah, and it's made of oil. All right, my friend, thank you very much. Appreciate that. And I appreciate that information, which I did not know. All right, some open lines for you at 248-544-WRIF.
And it's our final segment of the night. And also, I want to plead to John, who called in earlier, the Iraq veteran, to please call back, because I want to get your information. I want to direct you to some places. But if you're not in the headspace to call back, I understand. Please contact your VA.
He said he didn't do the Internet, but if you do, call talkyes@yahoo.com.
Yeah, and send us an email. But
and I'm surprised that some of you other vets weren't able to say, yes, he should go here.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you got to start with the VA, but there are other organizations that we can direct you to.
All right, got one caller waiting, so it means got a number of open lines for a final segment. Got interviews at 1 a.m. Eastern. And let's talk a little about Obamacare when we come back. Michael Moore has weighed in, and what he has to say will probably surprise you.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call.
Wouldn't it be great to win $1 million a year for life? But wouldn't it be even better if those prize checks kept on coming forever?
Are you serious?
Introducing the Publishers Clearinghouse $1 million a year forever prize. Win and you get $1 million a year for your life. Then after that, someone you choose gets $1 million a year for their life. Leave a legacy for your loved ones. Click on the banner now or go to PCH.com to enter. February 28th, you could win $1 million a year forever.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Listen for your chance to represent WRIF as Mancard Ambassador and Grand Marshal of Monster Jam. January 11th. Details online at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much.
I think we had a piece of...
What happened to you? You get fired?
Where'd I go? I'm still here.
Joey Jordan
was the wrong production.
Yeah, it was. All right, coming up at 1 a.m., Thaddeus Russell, author of A Renegade History of the United States, How the Renegades are the people that really made history and shoved along the more famous great men of history. An example of, I'm forgetting my American history. Oh, the Boston Massacre.
I knew you'd come right back up with it again.
The Boston Massacre is when these troops, British troops, opened fire on these Bostonians.
Okay.
And that so infuriated people. It was one of the things that people say was this instigation of the American Revolution. Well, it turned out that the people that were shot at were these denizens of this tavern, and this was the poorest of the Bostonians. And one of the things that always typified the poor is that they didn't go for these racial barriers. So it was an integrated crowd, and first the first person shot was an African-American, Crispus Attucks was his name. First name Crispus and last name Attucks.
Yeah.
And what they were doing, they came out and they started throwing bottles at these British soldiers and horse manure that was on the street.
Okay.
And the British soldiers just, shot them down.
Oh.
So it's sort of like this. A lot of what we associate the development of history is with the great men and the generals and what have you. Thaddeus Russell says the poor folk, the outlaws, the prostitutes, even how the prostitutes were instrumental in creating this. The right wingers will love
this. This is what I'm dying to hear. This
feminism. Were the originators of they were independent women. They were often Western towns. They were they owned property, which didn't happen.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know. As a wee bit of a feminist myself, and I've often talked about this with my fellow feministas.
Yeah.
And how they are, because they're in charge of their own bodies. And they're in charge of themselves as women were.
Next week, I'm interviewing a woman on Tuesday for our next Sunday show who, I don't want to say she was a prostitute unless I'm correct, but she deals a lot with prostitutes. I don't know whether actually she was in the biz or not.
Well, you're going to find out, Peter.
Yeah, I'm going to find out.
We'll all be waiting to hear it.
Right. Bruce Levine is going to join us as well. He has written Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, How to Find Morale, Energy, and Community in a World Gone Crazy.
I first read that, I was thinking, because so much of what we discuss is the economy on this show, and so I thought you were talking about the depression.
Oh.
And we're talking about mental depression.
Hey, one of the things I want to direct you to my website, I think it's on our Facebook page as well.
What is that website, Peter?
Let me see if I can spell the last name. Peter Werbe, that is.
Werbe.com.
And I have, remember Phil Robertson?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Quack, quack.
Yeah. But the Die Nasty guy. But I have on there, final thing on these jerks, promise. And this
I think people are ready for you to be done with
this. Okay. This is such an incredible.
I'm done with it.
It is such an incredible over the top. Did you ever watch? Yeah, we watched it together, right?
Watch what?
That guy, that Southern guy talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Just calling them yuppies and showing what they look like without their beards and how they're just actors.
These characters were definitely created. They said, okay, so you created this duck calling device. Now we need to make you look like rednecks. And I mean, it's amazing because these photos, for example, their Christmas card photo reminds me of photos that in the community that I grew up in that they take still to this day, where they're all on the beach and they're preppy.
They look like they went
to Yale, and their kids will go to Yale, and Biff and Muffy will get married, and it's the white shirts and the khakis and the bare feet, sunset.
One real important.
And this is how they were.
One real important piece, you can always tell. And this is the Duck Dynasty people. A sweater with the sleeve tied around your neck, and it's always white or yellow.
Yes! They really
that's
were
what they're wearing.
This. And now to be that different from what you were, I mean, I know I've had a lot of different looks throughout the years, Peter.
Yeah, you have.
Right? A lot. I mean, I used to have dreadlocks, and you name it, I've done it. But I didn't change that much.
No. And here, actually, on my website and on the Facebook page, there's a photograph of Osama bin Laden and of Phil Robertson. This is unfair.
What are you doing, Peter?
And it says, long beard, head wrap, wears camo, likes guns, millions of followers, and a religious fundamentalist, and they feel the same way about gays, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Enough of that. And it says, final thing on these jerks, promise.
Okay, but on that video, if you want some good entertainment, make sure you do go to Peter's website and check it out, because this guy who is, I don't know who this guy is, but he goes off on this rant that is so funny. Peter, how hard did we laugh?
We laughed. Oh, no, wait a minute. Don't click on that. You got to click on where it says, Duck Dynasty is a fake yuppies in redneck drag con job.
Okay.
That's
you and
the
your
one.
Headlines.
Yeah, I didn't write that.
Okay.
Not the photograph. That's something else. But Duck Dynasty is a fake yuppies in redneck drag con job.
If you want a good little laugh over this, because really it's not a laughing matter to anyone who's gay or black.
Yep. Yeah. But here, one of the things is this caution, adult language. I mean, it's something we've all heard, but I wouldn't want you to do it at work.
Don't do it. Yeah, we don't want you to get fired over this.
And we don't want you to do it if your kids are around, if you don't like
them. I mean,
if
you work at a radio station, you can watch it at work.
Yeah, there you go. All right, some more calls waiting for us. Let's see. Oh, this person has been waiting patiently.
Good.
Hey, it's WRF, Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. What's your first name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, what's up, Pete? This is Kevin from Wayne.
Hi, Kevin.
Hey, I just want to talk about, I got a few subjects on my mind real quick. I'll talk fast so I can get it off.
Right, don't talk fast. Just
take a breath.
Take a breath.
All right, firstly, I want to say you guys are so out of touch with the weather. All right?
Yeah.
I pulled out of the parking lot at work, and I was in fourth gear, and I was driving at maybe like an eighth of a mile an hour. And I looked at my speedometer, and it said 80. And then I got home. And
spinning
I
your wheels.
Snow. Yeah, it was a lot of spinning. And then I shoveled my snow, and it was heavy because it was wet. And I was sweating, and everything was terrible. And I got it all done, and I went inside. And I looked in the mirror, and my Sonic the Hedgehog mohawk was draped over my face. I looked so sad, and I had these paint smears and all that crap. And then...
Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
All right.
This is Kevin from Wayne.
Okay.
This is Wayne from Kevin.
Right.
Okay, let him finish, though.
No, you were the one that was...
Well, I thought he was going to be a naughty caller.
No.
I thought you were heading to a very dark place,
and he,
Kevin.
You were about to cut me off?
No, we have a dump button.
Yeah.
But she wanted
went inside and you were sweaty.
I went inside, I was sweating, I looked in the mirror, and my Sonic the Hedgehog mohawk was draped over my face. I should have took a picture, because it would have been good.
You should have.
My phone was dead, because it sucks.
What kind of mohawk did you say?
Sonic the Hedgehog mohawk. It was blue.
Sonic the Hedgehog. God, he said it so fast.
I had three spikes, and...
Oh, I like that.
It was all right, but...
Well, wait a minute. Do you work at either a record store or a skateboard shop?
No, I'm a supervisor at a warehouse.
And they let you wear that, huh? Well, that's cool.
They wouldn't tell me. They don't want to lose me. I'm like top employee.
See, well, they're not judgy.
Yeah, but you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, if your hair was a little long, they would say...
Peter, it's 2014.
I know. You know, what's that song by Five-Man Electrical Band, Signs, you know that? Signs,
Signs.
What do you think of that? But let me see. What were you saying? Snow. Well, hey, I like shoveling snow. I don't have to go to the gym.
What's the whole point?
I don't know, yeah.
Do we have a point here?
The point of that was I was just letting you know that you guys are out of touch because the snow is wet and it's frustrating and it's heavy and it hurt my back. But anyways,
why are we out of touch?
Well, wait a minute. What? I just told we both shoveled our walks.
Yeah.
And how old are you?
I'm 25.
I'm older than you.
I like how he said, I'm 25.
I'm older than you. And I shoveled a lot of snow.
I don't know what he means.
And I was glad to do it. I mean, I didn't have to go to the gym.
I'm going to tell you a story, Kevin from Wayne. Okay, so anyway, I barely made it home from working earlier. And then I'm trying to do it like he does it, okay?
Yeah.
And then I went out and I shoveled, and I was hot and sweaty. And then I went inside, and my hair, my mohawk, my Sonic the Hedgehog mohawk was all limp. And what?
Kevin, We're going to say thanks for calling. All right. Hey, you have a good one. You know, don't do the hot and sweaty things. There's, you know.
I already got one offer.
Yeah, I know. I know. Let's see. Here's our next caller. First name and city, please, and you're on the air. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Brian again from Indio, California, BB 420, Detroit 420 show.
But wait a minute, Brian. Here, we got this.
Brian is a rule breaker.
Yeah, you're a rule breaker, dude. You must be, burned one. We have this rule. You can only call once in a night.
Yeah, because we want everyone to have a fair chance to get on the air.
Even though...
Is it pressing? Are we okay?
No. Okay. Call back next week and tell us about it. All right. Thank you very much.
Or email us.
Yeah.
Calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Right, right.
Because Peter emails everybody back. Every week.
No, not everybody.
Yes, you do.
Well, I send you the copies.
The responses.
The responses, but I don't, you know.
I think you do a great job at that.
All right.
I wouldn't have the patience that you have.
The only thing, you know, I go home. And, well, friends have asked me about this. My wife asked me about this. She said, well, what do people say about Obamacare? And I say, nothing. He said, what do you mean?
So no, they say that they're confused if anyone chimes in on it.
No one has called up and said, yes, I got it, and it's great. Or, no, I had my insurance canceled, and I don't know what to do. Or, I was paying $300, now I have to pay $500. Or, I was paying...
Or anything.
Yeah.
And I mean, wish I could say, because remember, I was going to sign up for it, but I'm happy to say, after all these years, dear listeners, that on the 15th of this month, I will be insured.
Insured.
With
health
care. And I went through different means. I went on my own and got my own plan. Yeah. And there are a lot of reasons underlying that we won't go into why I did it that way.
I wasn't going to say anything.
But so I got nothing, but I was a candidate for it.
Can I say... and your insurance agent is my handball league partner.
Yes.
In our doubles league. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Did you guys win last week?
No, as we were taking a break, our first game is tomorrow night.
Is handball?
Handball is like racquetball, except you have to hit it with both hands. It's played on we say racquetball is played on a handball court.
You guys are so weird.
And so you have to play ambidextrously, right? Which is
sure, both hands.
Yeah, yeah. So there's no backhands. So people always hit it to your weak hand, your left hand, if you're right-handed, right? And it's very vigorous. I mean, there's a less of a sweet spot. In other words, you don't have this big old racket face. You got your little teeny hand.
Can you be like a poker hand, like a poker face, where they don't know which hand is your strong hand? I don't know. Just thinking outside of the box here.
Well, the really, really good players, you can't tell. You can tell that.
Look how excited you get when I talk about handball.
Oh, I just want to go play. I just want to go play.
But I never even heard about it until I met you.
Well, I asked the other, you know, my teammate, your insurance agent, and the other two guys, we're going to do it, even though it's going to probably be about 3 or 4 below zero when we arrive at the gym.
You also play with my lawyer.
I do.
All my people are on your handball team.
It's the other way around. I've introduced you to all my handball buddies.
Yeah, true.
That's right. So here's the deal. Millions of Americans began receiving health insurance coverage on Wednesday under the Affordable Care Act. Years of contention and a rollout hobbled by delays and technical problems, according to the New York Times. The decisively new moment in the effort to overhaul the country's health care system will test the law's central premise that extending coverage to far more Americans will improve the nation's health and help many avoid crippling medical bills. So what I don't understand, wait a minute, in all this stuff here, Toby Mitchell, a self-employed recruiter in Napa, California, said she considered foregoing insurance when Kaiser Permanente canceled her longtime plan because it did not meet the requirements of the new law. Now, people are saying, well, here's just an example of this bureaucratic...
Why it's so bad.
Yeah, because they canceled these people's policies. I mean, the worst thing, of course, was Obama said you could keep it, but the...
Because they have all these new rules that have to fit. That's what happened when I got this through... Actually, I'll just say it, through State Farm. And they had to make sure that what they were offering was... up to snuff, as they say.
So what I don't understand are these people that are angry that they had a plan that was so bad that it really didn't give much coverage at all. I mean, astronomical deductibles. and you know, huge copays, and it was almost like not having it. I mean, I think what they had it for was like catastrophic illness, where because then you'd be covered, and some
like
of them,
major medical,
but then a lot of them had caps on how much you could spend. And how, you know, over how long a period? And all that's been removed now. But here, this,
depending on your plan, Peter, because there's platinum, there's gold, silver, and bronze.
If you have bronze, and you have bronze, right?
You bet your sweet ass I do. But this is pretty, here's what I can get. I can go to the doctor four times a year for whatever I want to go for. You know, we won't need to go into detail. And it's $35 copay.
Yeah.
And I have a $5,000 deductible in case anything huge happens. So at that point, I will be with the feminist prostitutes on 8 Mile trying to work up the money for my deductible. I'm just kidding.
I know.
I'm just kidding.
You know what? you know what the takeaway for me for this little segment is? You called my ass sweet.
You're welcome.
Okay. But here, this Toby Mitchell, so she had her plan canceled, but at the end of it all, Mitchell, 60 years old, decided to buy a bronze plan. Her monthly premiums will now be $575 a month.
And mine are like, I think it was $280.
Yeah.
Or $250.
Well, it used to be $288 on her old plan, but if it was $288 and didn't give her enough to qualify, or plan enough to qualify, what good is it?
Yeah.
And why is somebody in the United States having to pay, okay, if it's $500, like $6,000-$7,000 a year for medical care, when we have a $1 trillion war budget, which goes to send our military all around the world.
Priorities all jacked up. And that's why Michael Moore wrote the article in the New York Times entitled The Obamacare We Deserve. And you have that's on our Facebook page if you want to look on there at facebook.com/nightcall.
Want to read a little of it?
Also, I have it.
Oh, okay.
And we can read together, Peter. And it's also on Peter's website at peterwerby.com. If you're not on Facebook, you can always go to that and check it out because it's a really good article.
Let me
Why
say a lot of people have had their, in this article we're reading from the New York Times, a woman, 37-year-old lawyer. She had no insurance. Maybe she's not doing well. And she's going to start seeing a primary care doctor to get her first mammogram. She's been uninsured for 16 months, and her monthly premium, $350, still expensive, but she said it was worth it. And there was somewhere in here that somebody or other, here's a guy, William Hanna of Cleveland, Georgia, been uninsured for 20 years, said he was looking forward to using his new coverage to see a specialist for lower back problems and numbness in his limbs. Mm. And he, because of a tax subsidy, it will lower his premiums to $56 a month. Now, one of the things, even in the most charitable heart, which doesn't include everybody, the idea that this is all going to the poor, so the middle class in some cases is going to be paying more. That's terrible.
My doctor told me that under this, he was quite positive about it when I went recently to see him. And he said that he had someone come in. It was a family of four. Their gross income, I believe, was $90,000, and they were able to get on a plan.
Huh. Well, I think I may have said, like a lot of guys, I never go to the doctor. I have this doctor.
Yes, you do.
I don't. I never go.
Peter, you why do you put me through earwax stories?
I used to go to get my ears cleaned. Now I don't even go there. I mean, I figure, why am I paying $25 to have this guy that does ear surgery clean my ears out and charge the insurance company probably $200?
You need to get one of those ear cones.
Well, you know what? Boy, I don't know. They're talking about this. You know, they tell you not to use.
Why stop anywhere?
Yeah. They say, you know, don't use Q-tips. Don't put anything in your ear smaller than your elbow. You never heard that? Mom never told you that?
You got to clean your ears out.
I do. I do.
Enough of this. Move on. This is gross.
What? Can't hear you. I have an elbow in my ear.
Oh, God. I have a much, much more salty version of that, but I can't say it on the air.
She's out of control, folks.
I controlled?
Yeah, right. All right, let's take another call. Hey, you're on the air. What's your first name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, Vermont. This is Rick. I ain't talked to you guys in a long time.
Rick.
Happy New Year.
How
are
you doing? Happy New Year to you.
You know, I'm all confused. I went on this thing with this Obamacare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I got so pissed off. It's like, what is going on? What they talking about? You know, you paying more money than what you paying now. It's like, if you're going to give me something that's affordable, why don't you give it me like a, everybody go on there, you put your name in, you give us a card, we can go to the hospital and get whatever happens.
Otherwise known as a single-payer health system, which is what every other industrialized country
yes.
in this world has. Vermont has
Thank
a plan,
you.
By the way. Did you hear about this? Vermont has a plan for a single-payer system starting in 2017. If it flies, this article in the New York Times, oh, this is Michael Moore. If it flies, it will change everything, with many states sure to follow suit by setting up their own versions, just like gay marriage, just like the marijuana laws, things slowly kind of like the cards fall.
But you know,
that's the way it should have been anyway.
Yep.
Sure.
I mean, I got a friend that's in Germany. I asked him, I said, hey, you coming home? He said, why should I come home when I got free insurance?
Yeah.
He said, I got a card. I go to the doctor, get whatever taken care of, and blah, blah, it's through.
Right.
I don't know what's going on now. I mean, how can you pay $500 a month if your job ain't paying you to pay $500 a month when you got to pay rent, gas, bills, lights, all this kind of crazy
food,
stuff?
Well, you know, Rick, I think the people that have
other kinds of insurance
that have to pay that much, like this woman here, what did we say she was? She had 586 or something like that. That probably means that she's getting a decent salary. But if she has to have, if she's paying $200 more than she should, that's not right. Because, look, Barack Obama, like most Democrats, think there should be Medicare for all. When you're born, just like you get a card, and just like in Canada, just like in England and France,
yeah.
and in Australia, everywhere else, and you go in and you get your medical
Here's
care.
Here's your right to
yeah.
that.
And
now, also,
there's one thing. Okay. One thing. And one of the things the Republicans say, and believe it or not, I actually agree with them, they say that, like with the unemployment insurance, they don't want to grant it unless it comes out of some other expenditure. Fine. It's called the war budget.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
which
there
is
you
that?
Go.
How much is it per year? What are we at now?
Really, it's almost $1 trillion. They say it's $585 billion a year, but it's actually $1 trillion when you add everything.
If you do the real math. And Rick, also in this article, on a positive note, Michael Moore says, and yet I would be remiss if I didn't say this. Obamacare is a godsend. So we have to point that
people.
Out. But he said his friend Donna was forced to move into her daughter's spare room at age 52 because health problems bankrupted her and her husband, who she now has cancer again. As she undergoes treatment, at least she won't be in terror of losing coverage and becoming uninsurable. Under Obamacare, her premium has been cut in half to
yeah, it's crazy.
$456
it's
crazy. A
yeah.
month. Yeah.
And
I hope something comes through, because it's real crazy. Thank you for letting me talk to you guys tonight. Have a good one.
Oh,
right,
yeah,
again.
We always appreciate
yeah.
talking to you.
And where was
hearing from you.
In
Thank
this
you.
Article they were talking about why everything is, here, just right at the beginning. This is what's happening, why healthcare costs so much. Novartis charges leukemia patients $90,000 annually for their drug. Our health insurance chief executive, like Stephen Hensley of United Healthcare Group, hey, that's me, who made $102 million in 2009.
My gosh.
I mean, isn't that kind of criminal?
Yeah,
almost,
let's put a little bit of a magnifying glass on that.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things, and you know what? I'll actually end the show with something when we begin talking about the economy. But this guy, what is all happening here about workers wanting $15 an hour, about trying to this gap that's increasing in terms of between the rich and the poor? 400 richest Americans worth more than the whole GDP, the gross domestic product of Canada or Mexico. Global super rich now hoard $31 trillion in tax havens. The six Waltons have more wealth than the bottom 30% of all Americans. And the richest 300 persons on earth have more money than the poorest 3 billion.
They shouldn't be able to hide that in the Caymans or Switzerland,
yeah,
wherever else they're
sure.
hiding it. But boy, do they.
Well, hey, we don't have anybody to thank except ourselves and the callers and
listeners. Mark Pennington, our boss, for being concerned about us, and for Lynn for braving the elements to get in here to work. She'll be rocking and rolling you at 2 a.m. We have a couple of interviews. You know what, Peter? We have our listeners
to thank
sure. everyone Always. For calling. And thank you, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you, Jillian Jordan. And what I want to see, maybe I'll set the alarm, in 4 hours, this is when our morning show, Dave and Chuck the Freak, are supposed to be here.
You know.
That's right. Our program director said he has a, what are those?
Range Rover.
Range Rover, yeah. Yeah, he'll just be, you know.
And
He's Canadian, he's used to it.
Oh. He's used to it. It snows a lot there.
All right. Next week, folks.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
Hey, music lovers. Didn't find what you wanted under the tree? Hurry to Verizon to get the LG G2 for just $99.99. Verizon, click the banner to shop now. Requires new 2-year activation. Early termination and other fees may apply.
Wouldn't it be great to win $1 million a year for life? But wouldn't it be even better if those prize checks kept on coming forever?
Are you serious?
Introducing the Publishers Clearing House $1 million a year forever prize. Win and you get $1 million a year for your life. Then after that, someone you choose gets $1 million a year for their life. Leave a legacy for your loved ones. Enter now at PCH.com. That's PCH.com. February 28th, you could win $1 million a year forever.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Whoa, a few more days and there is an election. And everybody is weighing the issues, right, and voting it in terms of the issues that make sense to them, that they're analyzing it economically and ethically and all the other things that give forth to rational decisions about politics, huh? I don't think so. The idea that there's more to politics than just the issues that are on the surface level go back pretty far. There was a book printed in 1930 by a man named Harold Laswell called Psychopathology and Politics, and another book from the 1930s that heavily influenced me by Wilhelm Reich called The Mass Psychology of Fascism. In fact, that book still stays with me. In a lot of ways, I see politics through that lens. So it is a real pleasure to welcome someone who I have to let him say whether he thinks he's continuing in that tradition. He's Bruce E. Levine. He's a clinical psychologist practicing in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he's often at odds with his profession, but he's been in practice for nearly 3 decades and writes and speaks wildly on how society, culture, and politics and psychology intersect. It's a pleasure to welcome Bruce Levine to the Peter Werby Show. Bruce, thanks for joining me.
Great to be with you, Peter.
Do you want to be in that tradition of Harold Laswell and Wilhelm Reich?
Well, I don't know anything about Laswell. I know a lot about Reich, and I know that not in his personal tradition. I think he had hundreds of women out there who probably hated him. He was quite a cad would be a mild thing. But politically, he had some very interesting things to talk about, fascism and psychology and politics, and there are definitely a lot of things that he talked about in terms of authoritarianism that are real interesting for me as well.
Well, Bruce Levine, you have a new book out, Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populist, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite, which does not, on the face of it, sound like a book about psychology, but your other two certainly do, Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, and also Common Sense Rebellion, Taking Back Your Life from Drugs, Shrinks, Corporations, and a World Gone Crazy. Well, aren't you a shrink?
I am a clinical psychologist. I should say an embarrassed clinical psychologist because I view Get Up, Stand Up, I talk a lot about the different spokes in the wheel of why Americans have become so politically passive, why if you take a look at the polls, they'll show that, you know, the massive majority of Americans for many, many years have opposed these senseless wars. They don't even know why the heck we're there. Most Americans don't even understand, especially after Bin Laden's been killed, why are you even there in Afghanistan? So this has been going on for quite some time, that Americans oppose impose governmental corporate policy on many, many levels, but they just don't do anything about it. And so one of the reasons why I wrote that Get Up Stand Up was that I had written a couple of articles in 2009 talking with titles like Are Americans a Broken People? And these things kind of went viral on the Internet, and so a lot of people were really interested in this topic. And so a lot of that book is really about how to transform American political passivity, but also, too, for me, in order to kind of get there, is to sort of understand the spokes in the wheel of why we've become so politically passive. And one of the spokes in the wheel is my profession, the mental health profession, of which I am quite embarrassed by.
Now, expand on that. You're embarrassed by your profession. Why? I mean, they try to help people, both some of them just with drugs, others with talking therapy. Your colleagues are out there trying to help folks, aren't they?
Yeah, right, right. Well,
I meant that. That was a serious question.
Sometimes. And I think most of them feel they all are. And I think the problem is that increasingly they have just kind of become depoliticized in the sense of that there's no sense of, like, at what point do you help people adapt and adjust to a situation, to an environment, to a society that has, in fact, become insane. And so, you know, that was that thread among my mental health professional was much more alive when I got into it in the 1970s, 1980s. It was much more alive in the 60s. So you had people like you mentioned, Reich, who was widely known, but also people like Eric Fromm, who talked about the society, in fact, was becoming increasingly insane. And he was scared in the 50s and 60s. He wrote a book called The Sane Society. He was worried about that already psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, psychologists, all of us were kind of just helping people adapt to this kind of dehumanizing, authoritarian, non-democratic society, and that was going to be problematic. And so one of the things, which there are several that I'm embarrassed by my psychology profession, is they're not routinely asking that question, not just in terms of society, but in terms of families and a lot of other places, is like, at what point do you not help people adapt and adjust, and at what point do you validate that people's pain and their anger and their anxiety are very legitimate, and you help them kind of navigate their way out of certain environments. And so the other part that's quite embarrassing for me about my profession is increasingly you have these uses of these diagnoses called oppositional defiant disorder. So I work with a lot of young people. I've been doing that for many years. And so this, for those of you who don't know anything about these diagnoses, this oppositional defiant disorder, ODD, it sort of came in, a lot of these diagnoses come in 1980, the same year sort of Reagan becomes president, as his DSM-3 gets published, and all of America sort of seems to become more authoritarian, including the mental health profession and their diagnoses. And this diagnosis is not like what we used to call juvenile delinquents, or these kids are doing nothing illegal, these ODD kids. They are really, their symptoms are often arguing with adults, often refusing to comply with adults. Rules. I mean, these are the official symptoms. And increasingly, these kids, at first, they just were sort of behavior modified. And now, increasingly, they're being psychiatrically drugged. And this actually happens a lot more with kids who are more impoverished. Kids will more likely get antipsychotic drugs, which are heavily tranquilizing drugs for no psychotic conditions, including these things called ODD. So there are a lot of things about my profession. We can do a whole show about what I'm embarrassed by my psychology profession. But a lot of it has to do with kind of taking the spirit out of those potentially anti-authoritarian kids out there who represent this kind of spirit of resistance against illegitimate authorities, which we so desperately need, I believe.
I was so major ODD and ADD when I was in school. I was just lucky they didn't have those drugs around. I just got sent to the boys' counselor's office and had to write by hand. The punishment was you'd write by hand from King Arthur. You had to, depending on how bad you were, you had to write for an hour, you had to write for 2 hours or something like that. My guest is Bruce E. Levine. He's a practicing clinical psychologist in Cincinnati. And his book, his latest book, is Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. It is available from Chelsea Green Publishing. You can go to brucelevine.net. There'll also be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Now, if you just go through the titles of your book, about Get Up, Stand Up, Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, and Common Sense Rebellion. Well, you need a little bit of, well, maybe not. Let's just stay right there. There's a thread through there, isn't there?
I guess. What do you think? What thread do you see
there? the reason that Bruce Levine is laughing at this is what people do in therapy. They turn it back on you. What thread do you see there, Peter? Well, Bruce, what thread do you see there?
Well, clearly a lot of what I'm writing about, and I didn't really sort of realize it in the beginning of my writing, that a lot of it would tie together just about a kind of increasingly authoritarian society and the need to sort of challenge it. And that, I guess I should define some things. And an authoritarian really just simply means who somebody who gives unquestioning obedience to authority regardless, not, you know, who that authority is. And so an anti-authoritarian is somebody who assesses whether an authority knows what the heck they're talking about, or they're lying, or they care about you or not. And if they're not a legitimate authority, you don't take it seriously. That's an anti-authoritarian. And so a lot of what I care about is how America has become sort of increasingly authoritarian, and how a lot of our kind of institutions have created that, including my own mental health profession. And one of the interesting things that I saw just in my practice is this idea that a lot of people out there who are diagnosed as mentally ill, not just these oppositionally defiant disorder kids, but also people who are depressed, people who are diagnosed with depression disorder, anxiety disorder, even a lot of folks with substance abuse and psychoses, that are a lot of the reason why I really like doing what I do is that a lot of these people are not essentially mentally ill. They're really more anti-authoritarian. And the problem a lot is that a lot of my colleagues, not all of them, there are some rebellious colleagues, but the vast majority are very much more compliant, conformist, authoritarian type people. And so when they are around a more rebellious, anti-authoritarian people, it creates a lot of tension for them. And so they will more likely try to reduce their tension by diagnosing them, drugging them, that kind of thing. And that's created a lot of problems. And as I've gotten out there, and not just through my clientele, but a lot of public speaking and writing, I get lots and lots of responses from people who say that this totally resonates with them, people who had been diagnosed, again, not just with oppositional defiant disorder, but with depression and almost all of these kind of diagnoses, mental illness diagnoses. So the hopeful thing about that, I mean, it's sort of depressing in one sense that this huge potential army of anti-authoritarians who maybe, you know, once they achieve some political consciousness could actually be transforming American society, that the hopeful thing is that they are actually out there, that this whole country, this whole society isn't as authoritarian as it appears. The depressing thing is that a lot of these folks are being kind of diagnosed, medicated before they even achieve any kind of sense of political awareness, and that's one of the things I wanted to do something about.
And they take it on themselves as an individual failing or a problem. Usually, people that are depressed, that are anxious, that are diagnosed as ADD, it's an individual problem, right?
And that's one of the other list of things why I'm embarrassed by my mental health profession, is that they propound these kind of mumbo-jumbo theories. And, you know, people have to understand that psychiatry, starting in the 1980s, just really pretty much got annexed, taken over by drug companies. So we have, just like there's a military-industrial complex, there's a psychiatric pharmaceutical industrial complex, of which, so almost everything people hear out there, almost everything, every institution, pharmaceutical companies have control through lots of money. Almost everywhere psychiatrists get their education has received big money. Their continuing medical education credits, the psychiatry departments, the American Psychiatric Association, all these folks take drug company money. And so there is this one thing that they're hearing over and over again. And what has that done? Well, for years, of course, pharmaceutical companies, it's in their interest to have everybody believe that, for example, depression is this biochemical brain imbalance caused by, most recently, their theory that they perpetuated for 20, 25 years was that it was caused by low levels of serotonin. Therefore, you take their drugs that jack up serotonin within a neurosynapse, stuff like Prozac and Paxil. Well, that's going to cure it. It's a great theory to sell drugs, just like, you know, that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was a great theory to sell a war. The problem was both aren't true. And actually, even the higher-ups of the American Psychiatric Association and the highest levels of psychiatry have now finally retreated from that whole theory of, you know, serotonin being the low levels of serotonin being the cause of depression. But the damage has already been done. Most people still believe it. And in general, people have totally bought into the idea that if they are severely depressed, they've got this kind of individual problem, as you say, this biochemical brain imbalance. And what that does is really tragic because it gets you away from the obvious of, like, what really causes depression. And I can tell you what we know is associated with depression, and this is going to be common sense for everybody in your audience who still is, you know, lucky enough to have their common sense, is that it's associated with overwhelming pain. So depression is associated, for example, and folks in Detroit, I'm sure, can really resonate with this, the more you're like you're unemployed. I mean, the higher the likelihood of you being depressed increases threefold if you've been unemployed for a period of time, if you're on public assistance, if also other kind of pains, if you're completely isolated, you have no confidants in your life, and that's another scary thing of America. There's increasing number of people who don't have a friend, you know, any kind of a friend, and this, we've got lots of statistics to show how isolated people have become. If you're in a horrible marriage where, you know, people hate each other, that's going to be creating overwhelming pain, and you're more likely to be depressed. If you have a physical illness, so there's a long list of things that we know create overwhelming emotional, physical pain, and those are the people who are much more likely to be depressed. And once you understand that, you start thinking a little bit more politically. You start thinking, well, what are the aspects in our society and our culture that are creating unnecessary, overwhelming pain? And maybe we should be doing something about those to kind of help people's mental well-being.
The book is Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populace, Energizing the Defeated and Battling the Corporate Elite. My guest is Bruce E. Levine. He's a practicing psychologist, a clinical psychologist. And, you know, I'm taking our dog, my wife and I are taking our dog to obedience school. And one of the things they talk about is impulse control. So the little doggy's got to stay there and not bolt when she sees a squirrel or, you know, some distraction. And it occurred to me, given our conversation, that's exactly what they were trying to teach me in school. And we didn't have A, B, C, D, E, F. We had honors, satisfactory, and unsatisfactory. So it was H, E, S, and U. And always I would bring home a report card that said self-control, and there'd be a big U for unsatisfactory, right? So but on the other hand, a society demands conformity. Every society, even ones that work well, demand conformity to its fundamental rules. And so you have kids, for instance, or families that report, yeah, my kids were terrible, but then I put them on this or that medicine, and now they study, and they don't have oppositional defiant disorder anymore. So that you know, they're reporting these successes.
Well, it depends what you mean by success. And, of course, a fundamental political problem, fundamental family problem, fundamental relationship problem is what do you do with conflict? What do you do with the tension of disagreement, okay? This is the essential part of what the quality of difference in terms of societies and families. So, for example, if you have one thing when you have a kind of authoritarian society, a fascist society, one example being Nazi Germany, but any kind of fascist authoritarian societies, what do you do with disagreement? You know, people who disagree, you kill them. I mean, any kind of individual differences, you just get rid of. That's one way to kind of get rid of tension. It's very effective. I mean, another way to deal with tension is something called democracy, real genuine democracy, whereas you spend a lot of time having people really understanding where people are coming from, you know, why they might disagree. You try to not only to have folks feel respected and understood, you try to, like, incorporate different kind of points of view and ultimate kind of decision making. That, in one sense, is a lot less efficient. It takes longer. If your definition of efficiency is just doing things as fast as you can to kind of keep the assembly line moving, but if you care about having a society, or you care about having a family where there is a minimum of resentment, which is what I care a lot about, which a lot of indigenous cultures cared about, that was their primary thing they cared about. How we can create human relationships in a society where people aren't filled with rage, filled with resentment to the point where they feel like taking a weapon to a school and start shooting people. I mean, that for me should be the primary goal of a family and society. How do we have folks feeling cared about, respected, and mostly not walking around with a boatload of resentment?
Well, Bruce Levine, I can't imagine that anyone disagrees with that. I don't think many people are thinking about that. And those that are probably in the short run don't see that as achievable. It would take a real sea change, and it would mean it would have to do with the Bob Marley line that is the title of your book, Get Up, Stand Up. So people are listening. They're on psychotropic drugs. They have kids that are on Ritalin, and then I guess that's even old-fashioned, all these other things. They were so depressed until they started taking Paxil or something like that. And then Bruce Levine comes along and says, this is all terrible. But they couldn't function previously. So like I said, I agree with your vision 100%. But in practical terms, if you could, maybe this is too difficult to speak to an individual that's listening that is using drugs or going, pharmaceuticals to deal with emotional problems, or is seeing a therapist whose only goal is to get the person to conform so they don't keep having the problems that they're having at school or at work or in their family. I mean, how do we deal with that in the short run?
Well, let me go back a little bit, because a huge thing, for me that I want to get across to folks is I'm not anti-drug, okay? I'm anti-hypocrisy around these psychiatric drugs. And so I totally have compassion for a lot of folks out there whose their lives are such a mess, and this is especially adults. There's plenty of adults who I know well, friends that I have, that their lives are such a mess financially, relationship-wise, a whole bunch of things, is that they're so overwhelmed by the pain in their life that the only thing they could do is find some drug to take the edge off, okay? And what I'm really, it's real important for me, for not only for a lot of reasons, is let's end the hypocrisy about the difference between so-called illegal psychotropic drugs like marijuana and psychiatric drugs like Paxil, Prozac, Valium, all of these things. In many ways, these so-called, they are actually illegal drugs like marijuana are much safer for folks. Nobody's making a suicide attempts. Almost nobody I've never ever heard of, maybe you have, Peter.
Nope.
And you can't, literally, you can't OD, you can't overdose off of marijuana. So there's a lot of things that, for me, the concern is not, I totally understood. Heck, I've used, drugs, alcohol myself. I have to deal with health insurance companies. Nobody in their right mind who's got any kind of a soul who has to deal with health insurance companies doesn't feel like at least having a few beers when they're done with that. Alcohol is a drug. So all of us out there, a television is a kind of a plug-in drug. There's many things that many of us are using to take the edge off. I totally understand that. So that's one big thing. Another, like I said, an embarrassment of my profession is for their own financial reasons, especially psychiatry. They're trying to make this huge difference between these illegal, illegal psychotropic drugs. And by psychotropic, I should again define, that means any drug, which is marijuana, which is cocaine, which is Prozac, that affects your neurotransmitters, your serotonin, dopamine, and all of these psychiatric drugs and illegal drugs affect these same neurotransmitters. So that's a huge issue there. That let's just end the hypocrisy and have compassion for people. And then the other aspect of what you're talking about is like, well, what the heck do we do? And it can become really overwhelming if you take it upon yourself to kind of stop America from being in all these senseless wars that are bankrupting us and are just killing people and injuring, ruining people's lives and really aren't getting any of. And that could get you even more overwhelmed and more depressed. So a big reason why I wrote Get Up, Stand Up is to get more practical. What is it that you can do here? What is it that can actually not get you even more depressed to take on?
Well, this is so interesting to me, and I'm looking at the clock. We have about 3 minutes left with Bruce Levine. And how do your colleagues view, or how does the profession view people that, like yourself and others, because you're not a lone wolf to be sure, that see this the necessity of looking at the totality of society when we start looking at people's individual reaction to it? Is there within your profession a number of people that agree, or do they think, well, you're just straying into politics?
I think the really sad thing is that, again, if you took a look at the 1970s, it all ended, really, with Ronald Reagan in 1980s. Not with Reagan. I mean, as America just swung to more authoritarian society. Prior to that era, what I would be saying wouldn't be that radical. For example, like I mentioned Eric Fromm before. This is a guy who was interviewed on national television by people like Mike Wallace. People can kind of take a look at this on the Internet and see that. And this is a guy who had bestsellers, New York Times bestsellers, books like The Art of Loving. So it was not a radical point of view a generation ago. Today, it sounds extremely radical for most folks. And yes, the people who talk about what I'm talking about are few and far between in the psychiatric mental health profession, psychiatrists, psychologists, and routinely we're almost completely marginalized. So it would be almost impossible for me to get a job in a psychology department or a psychiatry department in America. Maybe I could get a job in a sociology department or a political science department, but the guys like I know, the very few folks that I know, they're getting jobs even in native studies department if they're Native American. But psychologists who are talking the way I'm talking are not getting jobs in most of the psychology departments, and that's why psychology students are no longer really being exposed to this point of view.
You know, as we finish up, I'm looking at the cover of your latest book, Get Up, Stand Up, available from Chelsea Green Publishing. And sort of the word after all of our conversation that really jumps out at me is uniting, because we are so isolated, as you indicated, people without friends, without family. And one of the things that historically we've seen in these mass movements that have swept this country and to change its basic definitions going back into the 19th century is that people came alive when they could have face-to-face communication and have a common set of values and relate to each other in a communal way, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the things that's most sort of scary, I mentioned, was a statistic that really kind of blew my mind was a statistic that that 25% of Americans, and this was actually a really well-done study that really probed deeply, just didn't survey people, but they found 25% of Americans do not have a single confidant in their life, somebody that they could kind of trust, talk about heavy things with. And this is up from only 10% just 25 years ago. So people are becoming more and more isolated. And I think one of the things that if anybody has ever gone, like one of the things that I think that the Occupy movement was really wonderful about, if anybody just would have gone to one of them, is just feel what it would be like. I remember there was a very small one here in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I'm at, but I spent a bunch of time because I knew some folks in the Occupy DC movement, which was actually organized before the one in New York and Occupy Wall Street, but it didn't get as much publicity. And I went to theirs, and I remember entering where they were situated.
Bruce, let me interrupt you. This is going to run out in about 30 seconds, so I need.
But it was just this wonderful feeling. I mean, you just feel all of a sudden like this wave of energy that people would experience, even if they don't care so much about the politics. They would be amazed.
And that sums up what is in Bruce E. Levine's latest book, Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. You can go to brucelevine.net. My website will have a link as well. Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Bruce Levine, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Great to be with you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Rev. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
Hey, music lovers. Didn't find what you wanted under the tree? Hurry to Verizon to get the LG G2 for just $99.99. Verizon. Click the banner to shop now. Requires new 2-year activation. Early termination and other fees may apply.
Wouldn't it be great to win $1 million a year for life? But wouldn't it be even better if those prize checks kept on coming forever?
Are you serious?
Introducing the Publishers Clearinghouse $1 million a year forever prize. Win and you get $1 million a year for your life. Then after that, someone you choose gets $1 million a year for their life. Leave a legacy for your loved ones. Enter now at PCH.com. That's PCH.com. February 28th, you could win $1 million a year forever.
Hi, I'm Joe Theismann. No matter what stadium I broadcast from, I'd always have to find the closest bathroom, just in case I had that sudden urge to go. My prostate was giving me fits. But then I heard about Super Beta Prostate's nationwide million-bottle giveaway, and I got a free bottle. What a difference it made. I don't have to go as often, and I don't have to get up at night as much. Now I wake up refreshed and ready to tackle anything. What's so special about Super Beta Prostate is that it's the most widely used supplement supporting a healthy prostate. Super Beta Prostate has sold over 5 million bottles, and it also has a trusted 10-year history, and it's all natural. There's no reason to accept the issues that come with an aging prostate. So get Super Beta Prostate today.
Call right now when you learn how to get a free bottle of Super Beta Prostate. Pay only shipping and handling. Call 1-800-459-7640. That's 1-800-459-7640. Hurry, supplies are limited. Call 1-800-459-7640. That's 1-800-459-7640.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I do a lot on history on this program, don't I? And it's because of the importance that I attach to it. I mean, we can't just think, you know, history began 2 weeks ago. I mean, people don't even realize, I couldn't even think of, what was Anthony Weiner? Yeah, I forgot his name already. That's ancient history by a lot of people. But we've got to have a fix on what came before us in order to deal with today and tomorrow. And there's what they call official histories. And you know what that is. Christopher Columbus discovered America. George Washington made the American Revolution. A couple other guys as well. Abraham Lincoln and USS Grant won the Civil War. FDR got us out of the Depression. And Ronald Reagan ended the Cold War. I don't even believe all of those, but whatever. But it's so superficial, and it's the official histories, and it's in a lot of ways it's how every nation kind of congratulates itself rather than really getting to the meat of what happened. Because history, the official histories, is usually admirable people are doing it all. I mean, the great men of history. Then comes revisionist history. Historians that over the last, oh, I don't know, almost 100 years have revised a lot of official histories. Probably the most famous for our purposes was the late Howard Zinn, People's History of the United States. But I have a book here that goes even deeper than Howard Zinn's in terms of the people. How about somebody that says drunkards, laggards, prostitutes, and pirates were the real heroes of the American Revolution, and that organized criminals helped establish Hollywood, birth control, Las Vegas, labor unions, and on? This is a book called A Renegade History of the United States. Its author is Thaddeus Russell. And Thaddeus Russell teaches history and American studies at Occidental College in Los Angeles. And he's taught at Columbia, Barnard, Eugene Lang College, and New School for Social Research in New York City. His first book, 2001, very relevant to Detroit, Out of the Jungle, Jimmy Hoffa and the Remaking of the American Working Class. And he's published regularly in places like the Huffington Post, the Daily Beast, the LA Times, Boston Globe. And he's also appeared on the History Channel, Fox News, and The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Let's welcome Thaddeus Russell. He's at his office at Occidental College. Thanks for joining us on the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thanks for having me.
How did you wind up on The Daily Show? Of all the questions, of all the importance of history, this is the one I first asked you, but how did you wind up on The Jon Stewart Show?
Well, unfortunately, it was before I wrote the book, and I had written an article for the Boston Globe about preaching the work ethic in children's cartoons, and I looked at Bob the Builder and Thomas the Train Engine and sort of argued that the things that are being said in those cartoons are in some ways very similar to very totalitarian regimes in their propaganda films.
That was like 19th century kind of stuff, too.
Yeah, well, I compared it to North Korean propaganda films. They're all about sort of making kids work hard like machines. And yeah. Anyway, so The Daily Show actually wrote a whole segment kind of poking fun at it a bit.
Well, I think I'm going to enjoy talking to you. I mean, that's one of the reasons I wanted to do the book. But tell us the premise of A Renegade History of the United States. I mean, sure, we want to get deeper than Columbus and Washington and Roosevelt, but drunkards, laggards, prostitutes, how did these ne'er-do-wells, as we usually think of them, wind up as, are they the heroes of A Renegade History of the United States?
Yeah, sure. So I look at the history of America through a lens that American historians have not looked through yet, including Howard Zinn. That lens is what political philosophers have said is the eternal conflict, the eternal central conflict in any society, which is that between the individual and his or her desires and freedoms and the community or the nation. And so I simply began looking at American history and that conflict and found that going all the way back to the colonial era, the people who lived for their own pleasures and freedoms against the dominant social mores or norms actually created many of the freedoms that Americans now take for granted. So we can talk about various examples of
that. I was going to say, give us an example.
Sure. Well, the book has hundreds of them, and that's why everyone should buy it. But
right.
So we can start with prostitutes in the 19th century. So in the 19th century, it was not okay for a woman to walk outside in public alone without a male chaperone. Prostitutes, of course, were the first to do that. They established that right, of course. So by the 20th century, that became sort of the norm. But prostitutes, women who were considered to be utterly degraded, were the first women to do that. They really pioneered that freedom for women now. It was not okay for women to earn wages that were comparable to or higher than wages earned by men. The lowest paid prostitute on average in the 19th century made five times more than the typical white male construction worker. It was not okay for women to own property. In marriages, the man owned all the property in that marriage.
Sure.
Many, many madams, these were prostitutes who rose to the top of the industry and owned brothels, especially in the West, in Western cities like Denver and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Seattle. They owned very expensive real estate, and they owned large tracts of land. And in fact, after the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, when tens of thousands of people were left homeless, a very famous madam named Jessie Hayman actually fed and clothed and housed thousands of people who were put out on the streets by the earthquake because she was so wealthy and could do that. So again, they broke through the sort of economic barriers that have been placed in front of women. Cosmetics were not okay at all to be worn by respectable women in the 19th century. It was only whores wore blush or mascara or tinted their hair. Prostitutes were the first to do that. They were the first women to show their skin in terms of clothing below their necks. Huh. Now, by the 20th century, of course, all of those styles became completely normal, even in the most conservative circles. The red dress in the 19th century was known as sort of the symbol of the sex trade, and in fact, it was called the scarlet shame of the streetwalker. Well, who wears the red dress now? Every first lady for the last 50 years. And that actually, people don't know that, but that when Michelle Obama and Nancy Reagan wear the red dress, that style was actually created by prostitutes in the 19th century. So that's just one big example, but there's many more, you know, we can trace back many of our freedoms, like the weekend and the vacation and leisure in general, back to drunkards at work and to slaves on the plantations.
That didn't want to work, consecutive days and long, long hours, right? Is that what you mean?
Right, or no more than was absolutely necessary. So it's always been central in our culture, and other historians are aware of this, and it's sort of, even most Americans are kind of aware of this. It's in the popular discourse all the time. You know, the Puritan or Protestant work ethic.
Sure.
Has always been central in American official culture. Now, people get confused about what that is, though. They often think it's working hard in order to get a BMW or a flat-screen TV. It's not that. It's not a means to an end. According to the original Puritan, inventors of this idea, it is that work in itself, no matter what you gain from it materially, is virtuous and godly. So,
indicates you're one of God's children. I mean, you shall know the elect, right? Those who would go to
Absolutely.
Heaven by their good works. Yeah.
Right. So that sort of helps explain why many rich people have volunteered their services. because, even though obviously they gain nothing from it or don't need to gain anything from it, they're sort of fulfilling the Puritan work ethic. I sort of make very clear, and this sort of needs to be said again and again and again because people forget it. They think it's this universal or natural idea. It's not. Hello?
Yeah, you got beeped, but never mind. We're recording, but we don't edit, so go right ahead, Thaddeus Russell.
Okay.
Yeah.
No.
Well, I'll just reintroduce you, say that the book is A Renegade History of the United States. It's published by the Free Press, not our Detroit Free Press, but the imprint of Simon & Schuster Free Press. And you can go to ThaddeusRussell.com. or my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Now, you know, I mentioned both the official history, the history of Howard Zinn that looks at the collective response what people met as they lived their lives, and you have a more individualist and lower order sense that of people that made history. Are they incompatible? I mean, they're all there, right? I mean, there were slackers that didn't want to work 7 days a week, and there was Samuel Gompers, and there also was Union. So it seems like they're all there, right? Or no?
Yes and no. So one of the things I do that's very, very different from Howard Zinn and most sort of new left or left-wing social historians is I look at the great leaders of American social movements, like civil rights leaders and feminists and suffragists and abolitionists and labor leaders. And what I found very early on in my studies, even when I was back as a graduate student at Columbia, was that they overwhelmingly shared the devotion to these traditional American values, in particular about work, but also about sex. So I just wanted to sort of finish up on my point about the Puritan work ethic. The work in itself is virtuous was invented by elite white men in Northern Europe in roughly the 18th and 19th centuries, particular people, particular time. It was not invented in West Africa, and it was not invented in Southern and Eastern Europe, that's where we had most of our workforce in the 19th century come from. Those two places was African slaves and immigrant workers from Southern and Eastern Europe. So when those people got here, the idea that one should work no matter what one gains from it, from dawn till dusk, was completely foreign to them, and they had to be eventually trained in that, and that's a big history that I follow in the book. But there was this constant complaints about black slaves being shiftless because they would only work as much as they needed to avoid getting whipped, and immigrant workers who would behave very much the same way. In fact, they were often compared to one another. The first Irish workers here in the early 19th century were often compared to slaves. The first Italian workers, first Jewish workers, all were compared to slaves. None of them believed in this idea of work being virtuous in itself, so they worked only as much as was necessary to live or to avoid being punished. And then sex, also. The idea that all forms of non-marital sex is wicked, again, that is a Puritan and then became a Victorian value central to our culture. Again, that it was not, an idea in West Africa. It was not an idea in rural areas of Southern and Eastern Europe where immigrant workers came from. And so when they came here, again, they had to be taught this. Now, the labor leaders like Samuel Gompers and the great CIO leaders like Walter Reuther in Detroit and even Martin Luther King and most of the civil rights leaders, C.L. Franklin, Detroit minister, who was one of the leaders of the civil rights movement, all of them, suffragists, feminists, all of them consistently railed against workers and black people and women who did not work hard enough, who spent too much of their money on pleasure, like doing things like going to Coney Island, or watching movies, or drinking, or gambling, or dancing even. They consistently railed against those things and told their constituents to uphold the Puritan work ethic. They also consistently railed against non-marital sex. So if you look at, for instance, the chapter on civil rights movement, you'll see that Martin Luther King gave sermon after sermon after speech and wrote columns in Ebony Magazine telling blacks to become basically upstanding moral American citizens and to give up what he called degraded and immoral sexuality, which included homosexuality. It included all forms of marriage, all forms of sex outside of marriage. And he was essentially no different in those ways than people like George Washington and Thomas Edison and all the great generals and Dwight Eisenhower and the rest of them. So that's where I really am different from the new left socialist historians like Howard Zinn.
Well, and this is extraordinary, and I don't know that I would fall in my politics to the people, the historians you just mentioned, but I mean, to my mind, this is extraordinarily important because in terms of personal conduct. I have, a great libertarian streak in that old song, nobody's business if I do. But who you've described is people that wanted in, the immigrants, African-Americans, women, and they accepted. Well, I mean, I guess I'm just repeating what you're saying. They realized that they had to conform to this Calvinist or Puritan work ethic as one of the elements of acceptance, correct?
Right, yeah. So in a way, that is, in a sense, the story throughout the book is the question of assimilationism. But my point is, it's not that they all wanted in. They all wanted in to some extent. Everyone wanted the right to vote, certainly. Everyone wanted the equal protection under the law. Everyone wanted to be able to walk down the street without being beaten over the head by a cop for no reason. So there's no question that those things were universally, sought after. But there is sort of a tacit resistance to the cultural expectations of Americanness all the way throughout. So that's really what the book is. It's a history of the Civil War among Americans over these questions. Who will adopt these very repressive norms and who does not? And what you see is a long history cutting across political spectrum, cutting across economic class, cutting across races, of people attacking those who don't accept these norms, and then the whole, of course, many, many Americans who just continue to live their lives the way they see fit, which don't fit those norms.
Huh.
The point is that the renegades, those on the bottom, those who were immoral and degraded, if you look back at what they were doing in the 18th and 19th and early 20th centuries, much of what they were doing that was being attacked, we now consider to be completely normal.
Hmm. So that phrase, uptight, all white, that was one of the definitions that one had to accept if you wanted entree into the dominant society, no matter what your color or gender or sexual orientation or whatever. I mean, there's a big, as you may know, there's always, actually, it's not a big debate, it's a small debate among gay men. And there's a group of radical fairies who say they don't want to get married, they don't want to, they want to live free as free sexual outlaws.
That's chapter 15 in the book.
Okay, I just got this. I'm looking forward to. I love everything you're saying. See, I don't see this as inconsistent with Zinn. I wonder, have you ever had any, I don't want to use confrontation, but I mean, do you see these historiographies as conflicting? And did you ever have any discussions with him, or written or otherwise, with Howard Zinn?
Never directly with him, although actually many, many years ago, I had just read his book, and I saw him just randomly on the street in Boston, and I walked up to him and said, I really like your book.
Okay.
But I've had a lot of conflict with other sort of new left social historians. Some love the book and some hate it. No, but there is a central conflict, and here's what the central conflict is. They celebrate and look for people in history who sought from below, people at the bottom who sought not just inclusion, but power, but
right.
Governing power, right?
Right?
I mean, these are basically revolutionaries, right? People who are looking, sort of the new left began with labor history. That's where I started, too, who were looking for union leaders whose mission was to gain at least some power or total power over the economy.
Sure.
And over the government. Okay, so the argument that I make throughout is that once you gain that power,
mm-hmm.
you become the repressor by necessity, because you are now the manager, you're now the boss, you're now the governor, you're now the cop. You must immediately crack down on disorder. And disorder comes from things like people not wanting to work and things like people not wanting to live in a nuclear family for the rest of their lives. And so all of these social movement leaders were aware of this. And this is precisely why they preached order and discipline and self-sacrifice to their constituents. So I am actually quite different from...
So what do you think of people like myself that at first blush, and I'm going to read through your book for sure, seem to accept both... I mean, I agree with the last part of what you said as well. That you can see that many times. I mean, what I usually say is that things, that what often can begin as protest ends up as a racket. But let's I'm looking at the clock. I think we could probably talk for about 4 hours. At least I could. I don't know whether you'd want to or not. But the book is A Renegade History of the United States. pardon me, and the author is Thaddeus Russell. He's my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. And you can go to his website, ThaddeusRussell.com, my site, PeterWerbe.com. And if you think, how do I spell that? Work with it. You'll get it. Let's use some other examples. And I'm just reading off of the press release here. It says that organized criminals did everything from established Hollywood. We could maybe get that Las Vegas, we know, but what about, you know, what about birth control and legal alcohol?
Hmm. Well, birth control is one of my favorite stories in the
book. Okay, good.
So the Comstock Act of 1873 essentially made birth control illegal. It banned the distribution of it, essentially.
Right.
And that was in effect until the 1920s. So this is, you know, it's quite amazing to think of this, but for more than 50 years, birth control in this country was illegal. Well, that didn't mean it went away, of course. Birth control was widely distributed. Condoms and diaphragms and other forms of birth control were widely distributed throughout the United States. Well, who did this? It was largely Jewish immigrants in cities, mostly New York, Philadelphia, Boston, who set up factories, birth control or condom and diaphragm manufacturing factories, usually in the basements of their tenement houses. And they were illegal. They were criminal. They often, they employed usually their wives and children in this. And who were their major customers? Prostitutes. So the biggest illegal distributor of condoms during this period was a guy named Julius Schmid. And he had a house right near Times Square in New York City, which, of course, was the red light district in New York City, and he produced condoms and birth control all the way through this period, and the prostitutes kept alive that business and distributed it. And he, in the 1920s, when it became legal, he became a legitimate producer, and he became the producer of Chic, Ramsey's, and 4X condoms, which, of course, were the largest-selling condoms in American history for many, many years. But these were Jewish, unassimilated criminals and prostitutes who kept alive birth control.
So when people are... I'm sorry, finish up, please.
No, that's it. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, when people become assimilated, they lose all their characteristics, their definitions that are any different from anyone else. And, the liberal social call or observation that everyone is really all the same. I mean, at some fundamental level, we all are. But that disparate, melding of what began turns out to be just kind of, pudding.
Right. So, I mean, the sexual puritanism was not a part of Eastern European Jewish culture, in the shtetl, which is where he came from. He didn't see any reason not to go into this business. You know, the only possible reason was punishment, but, morally, he saw no problem with it. But there were many of these factories all through Brooklyn and Philadelphia underground. It's quite an amazing story. As for alcohol, prohibition goes into effect in January 16th, 1920. On that day, it became illegal to manufacture or sell alcohol in the United States. On that very same day, Italian and Jewish gangsters in Canada loaded huge sleds with Canadian whiskey and pulled those sleds over the border into places like Detroit.
Sure, right across the Detroit River and Lake St. Clair.
One main point of entry, right. And in the Caribbean, they loaded up ships called rum runners and with alcohol and, sailed those ships right into Florida and Texas and unloaded these crates onto the shores. Basically, pretty much every bottle of alcohol that was consumed during Prohibition, and this was a massive consumption of alcohol, actually, even though it was illegal, pretty much every single bottle passed through the hands of a gangster at some point. So they were really, I argue, and others have argued too, kind of the front line in the resistance against this incredibly repressive puritanical law that was really the most unsuccessful law in American history.
This is the interview that I can't remember one going by this quickly, and we're almost out of time. I mean, is there a lesson here? I mean, when history is being made right now, I think sometimes people don't even realize what a critical period we're in. This your book, A Renegade History of the United States, certainly is fascinating and is a way to look at what's come before us a lot differently. But what should this alert us to, if anything, in the contemporary period?
When you see someone breaking a social norm that's dominant, think twice before criticizing them. because the norm that they're violating may be repressing you.
Yeah. Well, let me see. Nancy Cott, author of The Grounding of Modern Feminism, says, Thaddeus Russell is a troublemaker for sure. Whether you call his book courageous or outrageous, his helter-skelter tour through the American past will make you gasp and make you question, as he does, the writing of history as usual. And, you know, to me, that is an incredible recommendation. The book is A Renegade History of the United States. The author is Thaddeus Russell. You can go to ThaddeusRussell.com. And also my website, Peter Werbe. werbe.com, and they'll have a link there as well. Thanks so much for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciated it.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call.
Hey, music lovers. Didn't find what you wanted under the tree? Hurry to Verizon to get the LG G2 for just $99.99. Verizon, click the banner to shop now. Requires new two-year activation. Early termination and other fees may apply.
Wouldn't it be great to win $1 million a year for life? But wouldn't it be even better if those prize checks kept on coming forever? Introducing the Publishers Clearinghouse $1 million a year forever prize. Win and you get $1 million a year for your life. Then after that, someone you choose gets $1 million a year for their life. Leave a legacy for your loved ones. Click on the banner now or go to PCH.com to enter. February 28th, you could win $1 million a year forever.
Whether it's a serious fall, fire danger, or other type of home emergency, Life Alert is there for you. The company with its slogan, Help, I've Fallen and I Can't Get Up, protects its members. Here are some of them.
When you have a heart attack like I did, and there's no one there, Life Alert was there for me.
Having a secure feeling through Life Alert is ideal.
My independence is possible because of it.
Now, Life Alert can also protect you in a fire emergency with a system that automatically notifies our monitoring center.
Thanks to Life Alert, you can live alone without ever being alone.
With Life Alert protection, elderly people can avoid or delay going into a nursing facility. For a free brochure about Life Alert service, call now, 1-800-404-2454. That's 1-800-404-2454. Call Life Alert now for your free brochure at 1-800-404-2454.
The closest interview is exactly what's going to happen.
101 WRIF.
Right now!
The Riff.
I'm having trouble trying to sleep. I'm counting sheep but running out. As time ticks by, still I try. No rest for clock stops in my mind. On my own, here we go. Feel like they're gonna bleed right up and walking on my skull. My mouth is dry, my face is numb. Something's fallen out in my room. On my own, here we go. Drive. The clock is laughing in my face. Crooked spine. My senses dulled. That's the point of delirium. On my own, here we go.
WRAF and WRAF HD1 Detroit.
Oh, that's good to know.